Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 28, parts 9 to 12 of The Trial of a Time Lord, or better known as Terror of the Verboids. I have on the other end of a Skype line something resembling a vegetable with the face of a front bottom. That's Martin.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And yourself?
Good, good.
Excellent, excellent. Well, as I say, parts 9 to 12 of the legendary, infamous Trial of a Time Lord saga, season 23.
Infamous is probably the best word.
Yeah, it's the third story, basically. If you think of it as four stories, this is the third one. Season 23, as I say, Colin Baker's last season. This was the season that was supposed to save the show, wasn't it? But it didn't save him. And it comes that there was the mysterious planet and Mind Warp, and this one, and then the last two episodes, which have come to be known as the Ultimate Foe.
Yes.
This was broadcast between the 1st of November and the 22nd of November, 1986. And this was during John Nathan Turner's marathon producer run of the show. At this point, Eric Saywood was his script editor. And the writers, we're all delighted to hear, are Pip and Jane Baker.
Sorry, actually, for this story, Eric Saywood isn't the script editor, is he? Because he'd already left at this point.
Had he really?
He left during the making of The Ultimate Foe. These two stories were sort of produced together, but the final two episodes were actually recorded first. And it was during that period that there was a big bust-up between Saywood and J&T.
Oh, I didn't know all this.
Yeah, so there is no script editor credited on this story.
Ah, that explains an awful lot. No one edited the script.
Correct. Well, John Nathan Turner did, I think.
Yeah, so no one edited the script. Who knew what they were doing or anything about script editing?
Correct. Yes. Interesting background to this one, actually.
It is. It kind of percolates through, as we'll see. The director of this one is Chris Clough, who directed those two episodes of Ultimate Foe, and went on to direct in the McCoy era.
Some of the best stories ever.
And some McCoy ones. Delta and the Bannermen, Dragonfire, The Happiness Patrol, and Silver Nemesis.
They're always in my top ten.
A litany of shame, if ever I saw.
Oh dear.
The working title for this was The Verboids, and also sort of The Ultimate Foe as well, which is a kind of complicated story, isn't it? They were commissioned to write something called The Ultimate Foe, but that kind of ended up being one part by Robert Holmes, and it was the final part by them as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a real mix-up, because Robert Holmes, did he actually die or just became too ill to...
Yeah, I think, sadly, he actually died, but Eric Saywood wrote the final part, but then, you know, they had this big bust-up, and then he withdrew it and said they couldn't use it, so right at the last minute they had to bring in Pip and Jane to finish it.
The go-to guys, if you want some excellent script writing.
the title Terror of the Verboids was actually invented for the novelisation, so it was never referred to as that during production. So when the book was released, that was what it was called.
What was coming up on screen was just part nine, was it? Trial of a Time
Lord. Oh yeah, for all of these, all of the season, it was Trial of a Time Lord parts 1 to 14, where it is.
See, I've heard my memories to this are a little sketchy. I haven't watched it any of this since it was broadcast, and I didn't see all of it then.
I hope you've watched this.
Oh, watch this, yeah. Yes. I thought it would be rude not to, really. You might have been doing all the talking, otherwise. No bad thing.
I suppose the other thing we should say before we kick in with the breakdown is at the end of the previous story, Perry appears to die at the end, doesn't she? Her body is taken over by Kiv, one of Syl's race, the Mentors. Yes, that's kind of the immediate thing that happens before this episode, isn't it?
It is, yes, and the opening scene of this story is a kind of direct follow on that. Before that, can we just have a quick word about the theme tune? This is Dominic Glynn's rendition of the theme tune, and I think it's pretty awful.
That's what I've written down. Awful theme music.
It's extremely tinny and lightweight, isn't it? It's got no gravitas at all. The middle eight section sounds like it was performed on an electric kazoo. It's just awful. And as we find, and we get to the end of this episode, the cliffhanger scream that we become used to since towards the end of the Pertwee era is awful, isn't it?
Mm. It is dreadful. It's not a good start. Yeah, it just puts you off immediately. Mm. I think
it does. Yeah, there's no sort of power to the music. No sense of dread that you used to get from particularly the first version of it. The Peter Howell one's good, but the original version, I think, is just kind of scariest, if you like.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so as I say, Perry's just been seen to have died, hasn't she, via... This is evidence shown via the Matrix, isn't it? Which all this trial is based on. So we go to this High Council courtroom where the Doctor's on trial. The Doctor's kind of plods in, doesn't he? Kind of in mourning mode. The Inquisitor, played by Linda Bellingham, offers some kind of words of condolence. But the Valiard, who appears to be standing in front of some massive potato waffles nailed to the wall.
Why not?
Why not? In case he gets... His trials are long, in case he turns around with a fork and...
Just has a bit of a nibble and then carries on.
Yeah, why not? And presume...
Just tuck in when the lights go down and they're watching the screen.
Rattle some popcorn and eat your potato waffles.
Hmm.
But the Valiard here, of course, considers the Doctor's putting on an act, this act of mourning, because he blames him entirely for Perry's death and thinks the Doctor isn't actually that fussed about Perry dying anyway.
Hmm. Eventually, the Doctor thanks the Inquisitor for allowing him access to the Matrix, and he says that he's going to show his evidence for the defence, and he says it's going to be from his future. The Valiard jumps at this. He sort of mocks him, saying, is his defence going to be that he improves? And the Doctor says, yes, it is. He then says that the events concern a crisis that threatens a group of people who are confined with no means of escape, and what happens is going to threaten the lives of everybody on Earth. And they kind of sit back and look up at the screen and the Matrix. First of all, it shows the planet Mogar, a planet that's supposedly rich in rare metals. And there's the consignment of these being loaded onto a space liner, the Hyperion 3, to be taken to Earth.
Yeah, I was quite excited at this point because I hadn't really seen this one. I can't remember that much about it. I thought he said Voga. As in the planet of gold in Revenge of the Cybermen. Yeah. So I got quite excited, very briefly.
It does sound like he says that, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
All of this information is being relayed by the Doctor on a kind of voiceover, isn't it, at the start. He says that the year's 2986, that the crew's already on board and the last passengers are arriving, and that many of them won't survive as someone on board's a murderer who's trying to protect a secret. As he's doing this, you see the ship, don't you, this Hyperion 3, and the camera kind of moves up the side of it and pans into kind of a window and looks inside, and you see everybody moving around. I thought that was a reasonably good shot, actually.
I think it's quite good the way it merges the model shot with the live action, but I think all of the space shots in this are pretty awful.
Yeah, but this one I thought was quite well done. I agree with you. When you see the ship on its own, it looks ropey, but this kind of merging shot, it was done well.
Yeah, this bit was, yeah. So you see this, you see through this window, don't you? You see all the people kind of milling around in a kind of passenger lounge. It's a very sort of 1980s conservatory luxury chic, isn't it? It's a spiral staircase and some sort of rattan chairs and rubber plants and all this kind of stuff. And we see a familiar face, don't we? Not familiar in Doctor Who terms, but familiar to viewers of fantasy programmes. It's Honor Blackman, playing Professor Lasky. She storms across the room and complains to a receptionist. This receptionist is Janet, played by Yolanda Palfrey, who Blake Seven fans may remember played Kasabi's daughter Veron in the story Pressure Point. Professor Lasky complains to this Janet about her luggage being lost, and Security Officer Rudge appears. He's one of the many mustachioed or face furniture to people in this story. It's just quite weird if you first watch it, see how many moustaches there are in one place. He appears and he asks to see her cabin key. Of course, she's mixed up at 9 and 6, which is pretty feeble as she's supposed to be a scientist. She can't get 6s and 9s right. Anyway, she snatches the key from him and completely unapologetically and storms off.
Yeah, I was reading something somewhere and somebody pointed out that how did she get into the other room to know that her luggage wasn't there? She's got the wrong key.
Yeah, she's supposed to have gone into the wrong room, presumably, but it doesn't work, does it?
Doesn't quite work.
The whole thing doesn't work.
Floor number one. Let's keep count.
Oh, God. I can't count past a million.
Then we see a chap coming in. He's carrying a case and he picks up his key. And Rudge tries to talk to him, doesn't he? But he's not interested. And as he tries to walk off, there's an old man, one of the guests on board, Mr. Kimber. And he greets this chap as Mr. Hallett, and he offers his hand. But we've just heard that his name is actually Mr. Grenville. And he says that Mr. Kimber must be mistaken. Kimber insists, saying that, you know, they met on Stella Stora, where he was investigating some shortages or something. But this man is insistent. He says, no, it wasn't me, you must be mistaken, and he rushes off, leaving the old man quite confused.
Yes. I thought Grenville stroke Hallett was awful in this scene, didn't you? It's kind of denial of who it was. It's just really badly done. This old man Kimbo is played by Arthur Hewlett, who played Kalmar in State of Decay. It's his only other Who credit, as far as I know. Here we get the first example of what is my major bugbear throughout this entire story, and that is tortuous, awful dialogue. Instead of saying, a familiar face, or something along those lines, he says, at least one face not belonging to a stranger.
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
It's a bit of a scenic route of saying what he's trying to say, isn't it?
It is. Why use two words when 55 will do?
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, more of that later.
This conversation has been overheard by, well, most people in the room, actually, including Lasky and her assistants, Bruckner and Doland.
And Bruckner has a moustache.
Yeah, another moustache. So that's Lasky, Bruckner, and... Rudge.
If we get a close-up of Lasky, I'm sure there'd be whiskers.
Bruckner's concerned that he might be an investigator from this conversation, and Lasky asks him to go and check the safety measures for the isolation room. More of which later.
Yes. Down into the cargo hold of the Hyperion 3, there's some staff sort of handling some crates, really, aren't they? They're getting some stuff on board. Grenville stroke Hallett appears and moves around furtively in the background. Then he manages, while their backs are turned, to go in and put on one of their outfits, which come complete with welding masks for some reason. Then the sort of head of this sort of staff, he's kind of the officer of the guard, isn't he? Who has a moustache, says that's the final batch and tells one of the operatives to get his men ashore. We then get a brief shot on the bridge of the Hyperion and then an awful space sequence as the ship moves out of orbit and away from Mogar.
And from awful to even more awful. We're inside the TARDIS.
And who do we find in there, Martin?
We find a big fat bloke on an exercise bike. And
and a tedious gingerbird.
Yes. This scene must go down as one of the worst ever scenes in Doctor Who.
It must, yeah.
Yeah, you got the Doctor, Colin Baker, of course, on an exercise bike, and Mel is kind of timing him as he as he kind of works this machine. She goes out of the room at one point, doesn't he? And he continues to count along, but he stops pedalling, and starts again when she comes back in, which I think is supposed to be funny.
Yeah, to hilarious effect.
And she comes back in with two glasses of carrot juice, and then we get some really dire dialogue about him not liking it and worrying that his ears are starting to grow longer. Oh, it just gets worse and worse, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just feeble, isn't it?
She says, when I start calling you Neddy, then you should worry. You'll worry sooner when I start to bray. And then he sips his carrot juice and makes a disgusted face.
Yeah, this is crap, isn't it?
Not to put too fine a point on it, yes.
Absolutely dreadful. But into the dingy communications room on the Hyperion, Officer Edwards is on there looking at a screen that warns of an unidentified craft. Then we see Janet receptionist walking down the corridor with some coffee on a tray, which she does for most of the story. And a gloved hand taps her on the shoulder, kind of startling her. She turns to see this helmeted alien figure ranting at her unintelligibly. She tells him to turn on his translator. And at this point he hits a button on this enormous device strapped to his chest. And then he starts speaking in English and complains about them departing late. But she sort of counters that by explaining that the reason they were late is because they were waiting for a late boarder, another Megarian. So, in other words, it's all your fault, you Megarians. And this Megarian just stomps off without a please or thank you.
And then she opens a nearby door and goes inside this communications room and takes in a cup of coffee to the man inside, who's a chap called Edwards. And she asks if there's anything interesting on the screens, and he says that there's an unidentified craft which won't respond to his hails. She suggests it might be space flotsam, and he very patronisingly says that she makes delicious coffee.
Yeah,
that was quite a good one. I thought
it was quite good, actually. It was good, yeah.
And she takes it quite well, doesn't she, and says, well, if you don't want my advice, and leaves him to it.
Yeah, it's a bit sort of flirty, isn't it, all this, really? She's kind of mock indignation from her, isn't it? And they obviously know each other really well.
She leaves, and as he continues to try and contact this ship, someone creeps in the door behind him. Surely Janet must have seen who it was, though. Because she, like, leaves, and then like a second later, somebody comes through the same door.
Yes. Maybe this person was attached to the ceiling at this point and just dropped behind her and she left.
Oh, could well have been. Anyway, this person injects Edwards in the neck with something, and he collapses. And this person starts twiddling some knobs.
Yes.
On the console.
Yeah, well, there was only one other person there, so...
Well, yes, or he might have... No, we won't get there.
No, we won't. So back in the TARDIS console room, Mel is skipping, which is dull. And then the console bleeps, and the doctor tells it's a Mayday message and asks her to hit the red button. She does, but he comes over and hits another button. She says, but you said red. And he says, must be the carrot juice making me colourblind. What?
Don't ask me to explain it, Jim.
Sorry. Yeah, what was I thinking? I doubt if Pip and Jane could explain it. Anyway, the message is unsigned, but it reads, imperative traitor be identified before landing Earth, Mayday end. And the sender of this cryptic message is apparently very close. Sure enough, the TARDIS, I guess, follows this and materialises in the cargo hold of the Hyperion. Mel leaves the TARDIS first, thus demonstrating that Bonnie Langford can't even leave the TARDIS naturalistically. She jumps out and whirls around looking at her surroundings, and you expect her to break into song, don't you? Yeah, Stranger in Paradise or something. It's awful. Anyway, she's quite anxious that they find the sender of the Mayday. But the doctor is a little bit more circumspect about it, isn't he? Kind of warning her not to rush into anything. Meanwhile, a guard has spotted them, and he creeps along a walkway towards them.
And we also see a Megarian lurking around, don't we? The doctor suddenly decides that he can sense evil. Why would he suddenly think he can sense evil down there?
Don't know. At least he sensed it rather than scented it, like William Hartnell. But it's lame, though, isn't it? Obviously, it's lame.
It's lame, yeah. I mean, it just... To me, it didn't feel right at all. You know, it's like, oh, come on.
It's an attempt to build up some sort of tension, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a bit of a cheap way of doing it, I think. Ooh, I can sense something evil. Ooh, something terrible is going to happen, I expect. There are better ways of doing it than that.
There are, definitely. Anyway, the Doctor decides he's going to head back to the TARDIS, but as he starts to head back that way, they're apprehended by a couple of the security men. Up on the bridge, Edwards is being questioned by the captain and Rudge about what happened to him. He said he didn't see or hear anything. The security tape was deactivated, so whoever knocked him out knew their procedures. And they suppose that the only motive must have been to send a message. The captain dismisses Edwards and tells him to report to a medic before returning to duty. As Edwards is about to leave, the Doctor and Mel are brought in. And the Doctor recognises the captain and he greets him as Captain Tonka Travers. Travers corrects him and he says that he's a Commodore, actually. And he's not very pleased to see the Doctor at all, is he?
He isn't, no. They've clearly met before, obviously. But, yeah, this is another great line of dialogue, isn't there? The last time they met, the Doctor landed him in a web of mayhem and intrigue.
Yes.
And naturally put. Apparently, the Tonka nickname was an ad-lib by Colin Baker.
Hmm.
I don't know if Captain Travers was indestructible anyway, but the old Tonka toys. Whether he's just got a big Tonka.
Well, I couldn't possibly comment.
No, not without an explicit tag.
No. Rudge wants to know how the Doctor got there, but the Commodore says that he knows how he got there, but he doesn't know why. This surprises the Doctor, because he assumed that it was him that had sent the Mayday message. Mel says that they had to respond, and Edwards pipes up that, oh yes, that's true, and he's still there in the background, isn't he?
Yeah.
The Commodore says that he knows that and sends him away again, doesn't he? The Doctor points out to the Commodore that the last time they met, he saved his ship. But the Commodore wasn't convinced that if he hadn't been there, would it even have been at risk in the first place? Which I thought was quite good, actually.
Yeah.
And then the Doctor makes a leave, but the Commodore stops him and, you know, he wants to keep him where he can see him. And he orders Rudge to take them to the lounge and says that they're restricted to the passenger quarters and they're taken away.
Yes, at this point, Rudge reveals this is his last voyage as a security officer. And there seems to be a little bit of a history between the Commodore and Rudge, doesn't there? They don't seem to get on particularly well. But he tells Rudge not to restrict the Doctor too much. He reckons if they give him enough rope, the Doctor will snare our culprit for us. Then we see a sign saying, warning, high-intensity light forbidden, infrared spectrum light only, on a polythene-covered link fence. And then we pan down and see that this fence has been breached. Inside there's a collection of man-sized plant pods that are being fed by a collection of sort of fluids that have clearly been set up by somebody. And there's a kind of an adjoining sort of cubicle, kind of a small lab area, isn't there? And we see a Megarian loitering in there. A shaft of we can only assume a non-infraspectrum light is shining out from this cubicle and falling on one of the seed pods, which as a result is glowing gently. Inside this little cubicle, the Megarian steals some silver beans from a jar marked Demeter. Demeter is a Greek goddess of grain and fertility, which becomes relevant later on. Then this Megarian turns off the light and leaves, and the pod sort of either kind of stops glowing or at least slows down a bit, doesn't it?
Mm. Elsewhere in the lounge, we see the Doctor and Mel. They're kind of just sitting in a couple of chairs. The Doctor refers to her coming from Pea's Pottage, trying to give her, desperately to give her some background.
Yeah, we should point out that Mel has never been seen before. As this is in the Doctor's future, we don't actually see on screen the two meeting, do we? But they say a few remarks which indicate that Mel knows him quite well and he knows her quite well, so we're kind of led to believe that this is not the first adventure they've had and they've known each other for a little while.
Mm. Mel thinks that he looks worried. The Doctor says that he thinks he's being used. The person that sent the message obviously knew him. Mel suggests that it might be the Commodore. What does she say there? Something awful.
Yes, he's a made-to-measure candidate.
That's right, yeah.
I think I used that phrase the other day. No, I regularly use that phrase.
It sounded familiar when she said it, actually. Yeah. But the Doctor's not convinced. Mel wants to solve the mystery, but the Doctor thinks it could be dangerous. She suggests that he go and ask for a passenger list while she has a poke around. obviously, if he recognises somebody, then that's probably who sent the message.
Yeah, I've got something quite controversial to say at this point about the character of Mel.
What, you fancy her?
Not that controversial, no.
Okay.
Oh. I think, this is despite her acting style, I think she's a breath of fresh air.
Right.
This podcast is at an end.
Really?
As a character, as I say, nothing to do with Bonnie Langford. Because we've had Tegan and we've had Perry as the last two female companions, haven't we? Forever whinging, forever looking and almost saying as much as they'd rather be somewhere else throughout. Mel is extremely enthusiastic and she makes stuff happen and, you know, she's interested in solving this mystery and she's always got full of suggestions. And, you know, she's quite brave as well. She goes into danger and stuff fairly willingly. I mean, she screams her out when she's there, but... so I think after quite a number of years with those two female companions, I think she's a breath of fresh air as the character is written.
Yeah, I think you can see why they chose a character like that, you know, why they wanted a character like that. And it makes more sense for the Doctor to be travelling with somebody like that.
It does.
However, I just can't get past the fact that she's just so bloody awful.
Yeah, I mean, that does... That does ruin what they're trying to do. Yeah.
You know, the breath of fresh air soon turns fetid, doesn't it?
Yes, it soon becomes the flapping of a fly-blown Kazi door.
Yeah. Well, I do know what you're saying, though, and I probably agree with it to a certain extent. If it had the right casting, it could have been a really good character.
Mm, yeah, definitely.
But unfortunately, it didn't, and... There's not much we can do about it now, but it's a shame, really. It's a missed opportunity.
Oh, it definitely is, yeah. They had the right idea, I think. Alas, some stunt casting got in the way.
I know. Let's cast somebody really well-known who can't act.
Hmm. Really well-known in such a way as to make all Doctor Who fans throw their hands up in horror when they hear that she's been cast. And unlike Catherine Tate, not change anybody's mind when she gets in there and plays the role.
Oh, well.
So this new and enthusiastic companion goes and tries the door of cabin number 8, just as Rudge appears around the corner, and she kind of jumps away from the door and just looks at, I think it's a kind of schematic chart of the ship, isn't it? She claims to be looking for the gym, and he offers to take her there. Clearly, he wants to get her there without her snooping anywhere else on the way. And then we cut back to the Doctor, and the Doctor's asking Janet for a copy of the passenger list, as suggested by Mel. And then there's a very brief scene where you see Bruckner putting on a surgical mask, and he goes past a guard who's guarding the door of the isolation room, and Bruckner's carrying some medical equipment with him.
Professor Lasky is in the gym doing some sit-ups, and Rudge is instructing Mel to put on a headset. There's a little kind of booth, isn't there, where... the music is controlled from, and he turns the music right up to maximum, doesn't he? Blowing her eardrums.
Dreadful music as well.
Yeah, it's dreadful music. Anyway, so he tells her that if she gets tired of aerobics, she can come in and change the tape, and he leaves. And then we see Doland enter, and he goes over to Lasky and tells her that the hydroponic centre has been broken into. She tells him to get Bruckner, and the two run off. Mel's sort of continuing her prancing about, and the music stops, doesn't it? And from her reaction, we can tell that a voice is speaking to her, although we don't hear it. Mm. And she sort of goes over to see who it is, but when she goes into this little booth, there's nobody there. And she opens a door at the back, which opens into a corridor, but that also is empty.
Yes.
So a bit of a mystery there.
Yeah, a bit of intrigue. We just need some mayhem now, don't we? So, yes. Back at the reception desk, the Doctor is trying to persuade Janet to give him this passenger list, using some conjurer's flowers and a rather drippy, gimboid expression. Doesn't seem to be getting him very far, but Rudge appears, and of course, under instructions from the Commodore, he's only too happy to give the Doctor the sight of the passenger list. And the Doctor has a look, but doesn't recognise any of the names, and the Doctor's disappointed, and so is Rudge. So they're hoping that he's going to be solving the mystery for them.
He points out again that this is his last voyage, doesn't he? He's going to retire at the end of it, just in case you hadn't picked that up earlier.
These things really need to be rammed down your throat several times.
Mel comes in at this point, doesn't she? Mm. And she tells the Doctor that somebody's been in touch with her, and they want the Doctor to meet them in Cabin 6. Mel wants to go there immediately, but the Doctor thinks it's a trap. I mean, there's some convoluted dialogue about a Judas goat. Isn't there?
Mm.
He says that he's just going to go off for a stroll around the deck instead. And then we see the three scientists arriving in the hydroponic centre. Bruckner goes into the little hut, doesn't he? While Lasky has a real go at Dolan for not repairing the damage outside.
Yes, you appalling dunderhead.
And, for not checking the pods, but he says he did check the pods, and they're stable. Bruckner comes out of the hut. Oh, he's got an empty jar, hasn't he? He says the Demeter seeds have gone. And then we see Mel going into Cabin 6. It's in the right mess, isn't it? Somebody's obviously been in there and turned it upside down looking for something. And then the Doctor appears, doesn't he, from the inner door. And there's kind of like I guess it's the shower room that appears to be in the other cabins.
Yeah, it's the ensuite, isn't it?
And his head pops out of there, and she has a go at him for trying to put her off going with him. And he says, there was no point two heads being put in the noose. It's just some more awful dialogue, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you never heard of safety in numbers? It's just all kind of little sound bites, isn't it? All their speech to each other.
It's just a selection of cliches, isn't it? Dusted off just, and given an airing.
Anyway, the Doctor finds these Demeter seeds, the missing seeds, and picks them up and starts looking at them.
Yeah, they reckon a fight for survival is taking place in the cabin, don't they? They wonder who won it.
Oh, yeah, there's also a one shoe there, isn't there?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so a one-legged man. Yes. So then we cut to Rudge, who's contacting Travers, Commodore Travers on the bridge, and he tells him to come to the waste disposal area where there's been an accident. The Doctor and Mel are walking through the corridors, and they bump into Janet, who tells them about the emergency. She's quite happy to tell them about stuff that's happening, really staff matters. But anyway, in the waste disposal unit, there's an unconscious crewman who's lying by this kind of a furnace, isn't it? And you find out it's the pulverizer. Travers comes out with another piece of clunky dialogue. They believe that someone's been chucked in this pulverizer. And he said, whoever's been dumped in there has been pulverized into fragments and sent floating into space. And in my book, that's murder. Yep, it is. It's not shoplifting.
It's like a line from Alan Partridge, isn't it?
It is. It's like a spoof.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
But there is the partner to the shoe they found in Cabin 6. The Doctor and Mel arrive, and they work out that the pulverized personage must have been Grenville from Cabin 6, a mineralogist, apparently. This is not someone the Doctor knows, so there's still a mystery of who did the Mayday signal in the first place. Travers is doing what someone eventually always says in a Doctor Who story in the classic series. Every time the Doctor turns up, people die. Mel protests, but the Doctor says he's perfectly within his rights to say that because he's right, basically.
Mm. Bruckner and Lasky are back in the lounge. Lasky's relieved that the emergency was in the waste disposal unit and not in the hydroponics centre. But Bruckner does seem worried, doesn't he?
Mm.
And he gets progressively more worried as the story continues.
He gets extremely worried, doesn't he?
Yes. Just to lose his grip a little.
He does a little. There's a kind of feeble joke at the beginning of this, isn't there? You see, just for a second, you have to look quite carefully. You see that Professor Lasky is reading Murder on the Orient Express by Agatha Christie.
Oh, yeah.
Which is what this story is based on, really. So.
Yeah.
Ooh, what a postmodern joke. Isn't it funny?
Yes. Anyway, Mel and the Doctor enter the gym, and the Doctor thinks that the trail is now dead as their contact's been killed, and he's ready to give up. Very unlike him. Mel suggests they investigate the hydroponic centre. And at this point, there's somebody in the sort of sound booth, isn't there, that's listening to them, and you kind of see him leave. The Doctor says again it's a lost cause, and he suggests that she go down to the hydroponic centre and leave him to his static and solitary peregrinations. At which point I turned off. I didn't watch the rest. Did you finish it?
I didn't go this far.
What on earth is that dialogue all about? It's just nonsense. To be fair, we then cut to the courtroom, don't we?
Mm.
Where the doctor sort of jumps up and shouts, "Hold it!" And they stop the sort of the playback on the Matrix. And he says that this isn't what happened when he reviewed the scene earlier, when he was preparing his defence. It was different. He wouldn't have ignored Mel's information about the hydroponic centre. And the words weren't even his, he says.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they do sound like something he would say, though.
Yeah, well, whoever's falsifying the Matrix has done it quite cleverly, haven't they? Interestingly, during the course of that so-called tampered scene, the Doctor uses the phrase arbitrary course, doesn't he? And the Valeyard also uses that phrase when he's arguing about the validity of the evidence. So there's a little clue there as to who may be up to something here.
Mm.
The Doctor's basically saying that he wouldn't have ignored Mel's point about the hydroponic centre or centre alone into danger in that way. The Inquisitor says that the Doctor must either continue the evidence or she will assume that his defence has been concluded. So he basically says, well, he can't stop it here, we better continue. So he reluctantly presses the button. And, Matrix evidence continues.
So we see Mel entering the cargo hold. And Edwards is down there, isn't he? And he sees her, and he sort of stops her and he says it's off limits. She says that, you know, she'd like to see the hydroponic centre and thinks it might have something to do with the Mayday call. Edwards reluctantly says that he'll give her a conducted tour. And he, again, he's kind of flirting with her for some reason.
God knows why.
Mel asks about Lasky, and Edwards says that she and her assistants are agronomists, and the hydroponic centre was set up especially for them. He says that only low-spectrum light's allowed in there, and he says it's something to do with photosynthesis, but he's not sure what. And he opens sort of the outer door, and he says he'll go first, and he says, we don't want you breaking your neck, at least not until... And then he reaches out and is electrocuted.
Yes.
We'll come back to that piece of dialogue in a second.
Yes, I think we will.
And it's quite a spectacular ending to the episode. Well, it's a very spectacular end to the episode, actually. I think it's probably the only good thing about it.
It's brilliant.
Because it's really good. Mel screams. He's electrocuted, and it's a really good effect around him, isn't it, as he kind of screams as well. And he falls through the door into the hydroponics room. There's sparks sort of flying everywhere, isn't there? And there's sort of things start falling down, and a strange green hand bursts out from one of these pods, doesn't it?
Mm.
And Mel continues to scream, and as everything's sort of exploding, and then the episode ends. And it's a great ending. I think it's one of the best cliffhangers ever, really.
Yeah, it's absolutely
It's
true.
Really well done. Yeah. It's a shame the rest of it was so poor, really. But yes, this piece of dialogue.
How was it going to end? We don't want you breaking your neck, at least not until... I can't think of a legitimate ending to that sentence.
No, it's a bit odd, isn't it, to say the least.
Yes, we don't mind you breaking your neck if something else happens. Once that's happened, break your neck by all means.
But yeah, you know, I'd say that episode ending is up there with the best. What do you reckon?
Well, it's great, particularly as we know that light is a very sensitive issue there, and all these massive sparks going off, and big bangs of flashes.
Mm.
Obviously, that's enough to just get these pods starting to break open. Yeah, it's very exciting.
And well done, you know, well shot, well executed. Mm, you know,
yes, definitely.
It works really well, I think.
And there's a little kind of callback to that chap who gets electrocuted trying to open the cyber doors on Telos, in Tomb of the Cybermen, isn't it?
Yeah, so I say.
So, yeah, these kind of triffid-like tendrils come out, don't they, of one of these pods. And Mel runs away from the scene and is caught by two guards. One of them is the mustachioed one we saw earlier. One of them checks on Edwards and says, he's dead all right. And the mustachioed chief guard sort of drags her off to see the Commodore. Once they are kind of on their way, the other guard is kind of borne down upon by something that we see from its perspective coming out of one of these pods. A verboid eye view, you might say.
Indeed.
Which is,
like,
again,
a green sort of filter around the outside. Isn't it?
Quite
reminiscent of a Rutan.
Yeah, it's an old Doctor Who trope, isn't it? It's always quite nice. It's quite well done, as you can see, sort of flapping through the pod.
Mm. Yeah, that mustachioed head guard. I wonder how many of him there are, because especially later on, he seems to be in about three places at once.
He does, yeah.
We'll pick up on that as we get to it.
Maybe he's one of triplets.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, we cut back to the courtroom again here, and the Vanguard accuses the Doctor of saying, you know, another death, Doctor, but for chance that could well have been your companion Mel. And the Inquisitor asks again why he didn't prevent her going down to the cargo hold when he had the chance. The Doctor says that when he viewed this earlier, it didn't happen like that. Basically, this scene is just going over again for those that didn't tune in last week, just to remind them that there's something fishy going on with the evidence.
Yeah. So they press on, don't they? The Doctor presses a button and all those Time Lords turn around again. That's all they do, don't they? That's the time,
yeah.
So the Chief Guard is hanging about outside the isolation room. There's a crashing noise from inside, and Doland comes out covered in food. He claims there was an accident, and he hands the guard a tray with a broken plate of what appears to be sort of eggs and toast.
Mm-hmm.
But the sound of the crockery being broken is a couple of seconds between that sound and him coming out with all the broken crockery collected up and put on the tray. It doesn't really work it out well.
Down in the gym, Lasky comes in and addresses the Doctor, suggesting he should wear a heart monitor while he's exercising. He asks which heart, and she thinks that he's joking. Again, it's terrible, terrible dialogue. He says that he's more of a clown than a comedian, and offers to give her his rendition of On With the Motley. What on earth is this all about?
Well, who cares?
Quite. This goes on throughout. The Doctor keeps making these really obscure references that, you know, why were they included? Why do they remain in the script?
Well, why did 90% of the dialogues remain in the script?
It's just terrible, but anyway, Raj comes in and he takes the Doctor away to the bridge, where we find Mel and the guard, the mustachioed guard, who seconds earlier was being handed a plate outside the isolation room. But he's just been taking Mel up from the cargo hold. That's what I mean. This must be his brother. Or he took her up there, just nipped down to pick up a broken plate, and then came back again.
Busy man. Busy man. Maybe he's an Auton replica.
Could be. They didn't follow that up in this story.
I wish they had.
Anyway, Commodore asks if the Doctor can vouch for Mel, which he says, of course he can. She tells him she's been accused of killing Edwards, and that the hydroponic centre was booby-trapped, and if it weren't for Edwards, she'd be dead. At which point, Roger's communicator bleeps, and somebody tells him that apparently Edwards' body has disappeared, and so has the guard that was left down there with him.
Lorks.
At which point the Commodore asks Rudge to organise a search.
Yeah, the Doctor suggests that the weird atmosphere down there may have led to phantasmagoria. I don't know what they're getting at here, but you know, people are kind of thought these people were dead, but they weren't, and they just got up and walked off, and because of the weird atmosphere down there, it's just feeble.
Hmm.
And then Mel comes out with another line of highly naturalistic dialogue to the Doctor. Oh, come on, you know me. Am I prone to that sort of imagination? Can you be prone to imagination? Imagination is not something that happens to you, is it?
I suppose not. No. Yeah, anyway, so we see a Mogarian creeping around in the hydroponics centre again, and he finds a green leaf on the floor and hears something inside the lab. Then we see Dr. Mel, who are passing a guard outside the isolation room. I can't remember if it's the mustachioed one or not, but it probably is, because he seems to be the only one left. He gets around everywhere, that one. The Doctor wonders whether he's there to keep people out or somebody in the room. Bruckner and Dolan find the destruction down in the hydroponics centre, don't they? And all the pods are now empty. Dolan says some fool must have introduced high-intensity light. But he says it very calmly, doesn't he? And Bruckner is amazed at this kind of reaction. Mm-hmm. He's really worried about what's been unleashed.
Yes, we're confronted with a catastrophe, and that's your reaction. Don't you realise what's been unleashed? No one talks like that.
Well, Pip and Jane Baker obviously did.
Imagine what the domestic life of Pip and Jane Baker is like.
Yeah.
Can you find it in yourself to pass the sodium chloride container?
Yeah, I think it probably is something like that, isn't it? Did they ever write for anything else?
Yeah. Apparently they're...
Such as?
Roger's Thesaurus?
Yes, that's probably more suitable for them.
Well, this is script writing by Thesaurus, isn't it? Right, this is the line, but it doesn't sound intelligent enough. So let's substitute every normal word with the longest word we can find in the thesaurus for that word, and then just string all that together, and that can be the sentence.
And then add in some obscure literary reference as well.
No one in the target audience will know. It's pathetic. It's awful writing.
It's a shame, really, because the script, or the story, is reasonably good, I think.
Yeah, they can write a plot.
There's no problem with
the
reasonable.
The plotting is quite clever, and it's quite dense and quite clever. It's the dialogue.
All over the place. So outside the isolation room, the lovely Janet is being handed another smashed plate of food, and Raj appears, doesn't he? And she asks him what's going on in there, and he doesn't seem to know either. He's not allowed to know what's in there, which he can't understand, as is the security, is the head of security on the ship.
So back in the passenger lounge, Mel reminds the doctor about these Demeter seeds and suggests that Professor Lasky takes a look at them, as she's found out from Edward that Lasky's an agronomist. So in other words, she deals with the agricultural science of crops and soils. The doctor says he'll ask her, as he has tact and finesse. So you automatically know what's going to happen, don't you?
Yeah.
He goes over to her, and she actually corrects him and says she's a thrematologist. That's all about the scientific breeding of domestic plants and animals. He shows her the seeds, and she immediately calls Janet over angrily and tells her to fetch a security officer. So this man is a thief. Mel sort of chides him for getting her worked up. The doctor pulls a face, and there's some crap music.
Well summed up. Yeah, then back down in the hold, Dolan and Bruckner are having an argument, aren't they? Bruckner sees a movement outside, and despite Dolan's protests, he's sure there's somebody in the hold with them. And sure enough, we see a Megarian hiding outside, don't we?
Don't you think there's an issue here with Bruckner, Dolan and Lasky? They're three scientists working together, and they all hate each one hates the other two, don't they?
Yeah.
They all hate each other. It just doesn't seem realistic to me. Most sort of working groups have some level of camaraderie. I know it's perhaps more interesting for there to be some conflict in there, but not everyone hating all the others, you know.
Maybe they've just been on Mogar too long together and confined space.
Maybe they're getting space sickness.
Maybe there was some sort of love triangle at one point.
Yeah, I don't really want to think about that.
Fair enough. Back in the lounge, Mel's obviously explained that they found the seeds in Cabin 6. Lasky says, it's a pity your friend the comedian wasn't so lucid. And then there's I guess it's supposed to be a funny scene where Mel and Lasky are discussing the seeds and wondering how they got there while the doctor tries to get a word in. And is frustrated every time he tries to say something. it's just, I don't know. I mean, Colin Baker in this really annoys me from start to finish. Probably more than Mel does, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's neck and neck.
It's neck and neck, but when your two regulars are so unlikable, you're not going to get anywhere with this, are you?
No, you're not hiding to nothing, are you? Add the script to that, and never mind.
Yeah, pretty poor stuff. Anyway, Lasky is explaining that the Demeter seeds, they increase the yield threefold, and they'll grow in like desert sands. So, you know, they're obviously going to be very useful. Raj appears, because he's been called by Janet to arrest the doctor. But Lasky tells him that she's made a mistake. The doctor may be a fool, but he's not a criminal. At which the doctor, kind of with another annoyed look on his face, throws one of these seeds up in the air, catches it in his mouth, and chews away, looking very annoyed.
On the bridge, Travers makes a course adjustment which will get them to their destination, Earth, 72 hours quicker. He's pleased about that because it means they'll have access to expert investigators 72 hours quicker, so good for them. Amusingly, back on the passenger lounge, two McGarrans are playing the, I don't think it's already antiquated by then, certainly antiquated by now, arcade game Phoenix.
Mm.
Admittedly, they've got a sort of holographic version of it, but it's still the same one step on from Galaxians. Rather quaint, quite amusing. Mel stops the doctor from having coffee and biscuits. She's trying to stop the fat doctor from getting any fatter. Bit of a cheek, though, I think. The doctor that we know from his first couple of seasons as Sixie, you can't imagine him actually obeying anything his companion said. So this is quite a mellower doctor, isn't it, that we have now?
It is, but also quite a more rotund one as well.
Yes, yeah. I mean, he needs what Mel is trying to do, but the old doctor wouldn't have taken it.
No.
Never mind, that's called character development, of course.
Hmm. Got loads of that in this story.
Yeah. So, Travers appears and explains the course adjustment. It's obviously fairly clumsily done, isn't it? Because everyone falls over and breaks their legs, and people drop trays. I'm exaggerating. I'm exaggerating slightly, but it's a fairly brusque course adjustment, isn't it? Mm. The McGarrans, unsurprisingly, are concerned, but they're actually more concerned about the fact that they worked it. If they're getting there that much quicker, the new course must be bringing the ship closer to the black hole of Tartarus.
Mm.
Then they start moaning about the Earthlings stripping their planet and the universe, in fact, of its resources, like a plague of interplanetary locusts, which in my book is Wirren, the Ark in Space.
Yeah, yes.
Not
we can watch that instead.
Oh, can we? Please.
Oh, we've already done that one. We'll have to carry on, sorry.
Blast. Anyway, it's quite obvious before it's pointed out later on that one of the McGarrans is understanding and speaking English without his translator unit turned on. Because they make such a show of pressing these massive things on their chests that it's extremely obvious when one of them doesn't do it.
Yeah, and at this point the Valiard stops the video again, doesn't he? And asks why they're being subjected to politics. The doctor says there was much more than that happened. There's something very significant. And the Valiard suggests he get on with it and have his moment of triumph. The doctor says, well, someone's about to die, and if he'd been watching, he'd have known who. And the Inquisitor tells him to get on with it. I was thinking the same, actually. It's just a totally unnecessary cutaway. There's a few of those. It's just because you got this long 14-part story, you have to keep going back to that at least once a week, otherwise people would have forgotten all about it, I guess. But it is quite intrusive, I think, at times.
Yeah, I mean, it dramatically it doesn't work because it's stopping anything gets remotely interesting, stopping it for a couple of people to shout at each other in a courtroom. And so it doesn't work. This story, from my memory, is not quite so troubled with tons of court scenes as the first two are, is it?
I can't really remember, to be honest. I don't. Funnily enough, it's not an era I come back to that often.
Oddly. But yeah. I just remember at the time it just happened every few minutes in the first couple of stories. But this one didn't seem as bad, and at least sometimes it actually makes the plot a little bit more interesting when something comes up here. But yeah, it happens too often even here.
Anyway, back on the ship, Janet's taking some drinks around to the McGarrans. The Commodore and Raj are up on the kind of gantry, aren't they, looking down at everybody. Lasky Dolan and Bruckner are kind of having a chat somewhere. And then we got the Doctor and Mel, and again, you got this, the Doctor says to her, "You're quiet, Mel. Not your style to go into a brown study." That, to me, sounds a bit rude, but...
It's something to do with dirty protests, surely.
Well, that's what I thought. But her response is the vocabulary of all Time Lords so antediluvian?
Yeah, she can talk.
It's just...
But, for instance, why don't you just say old-fashioned, not antediluvian? Thesaurus script writing is what it is.
Yeah. Luckily, at this point, to take us away from this diatribe, a Mogarian gets up and starts choking and clutching at its throat. And they all kind of rush over to him. And the Doctor starts to remove his face mask. Commodore and Rudger stop him, saying, you know, if you remove that, he'll die. They can't breathe oxygen. The Doctor says, well, he's not a Mogarian. And he takes away the mask to reveal Grenville underneath. Shock horror. The Doctor says... No, it's not Grenville, it's Hallett. The Commodore checks his pulse. He calls for a stretcher party to be sent to the lounge. And the old man, Mr. Kimber, he comes over. He says he knew it was Hallett. He recognised him, but he was insistent that it wasn't him. Mel asks why he was trying to stage his own death in the pulveriser. And the Doctor says, well, you know, Kimber's just given you the answer. He was undercover. Unluckily, as soon as he arrived, he was recognised, which jeopardised his mission, so he had to do something drastic. Rush is very annoyed, isn't he, that there was an undercover agent on board that he didn't know about, and the Doctor points out that, well, you may have been a suspect, which doesn't amuse him too much.
The Doctor says that he knew and admired Hallett. Now, this clearly is something that's happened off-screen somewhere in, I guess, the Sixth Doctor's history, I don't know. And that explains the message to the TARDIS. Obviously, somebody knew him. And that must have been Hallett. But Rudge wants to know how the Doctor knew that this person in Megarian guise wasn't a Megarian. And so does the Valyard. So we go back to the courtroom, and he accuses the Doctor of editing the Matrix. You see what he's done? He's sort of switch it round, isn't he? Yeah.
Clever.
Mm. The Doctor rewinds and shows them how he knew. As Colin Baker describes it, the bogus Megarian did not switch on his translator.
And if his face could be any more smug and triumphant, you know, I can't believe it could.
Yeah, it's
you terrifying. Just want to punch him right on the hooter, don't you, when he says it?
Yes, yes, you want to punch him upside his grill. Yeah, obviously he's taking his speech patterns from Sontarans, isn't he? Translator, doctor! Anyway, the Valyard and the Inquisitor, in fact, demand to know why Hallett was acting in such an unorthodox manner. The Doctor explains that this is the nub of his defence, and this is why he could no longer stay on the sidelines. You know, this is, in terms of the courtroom, this is getting right to the meat and two veg. Back on the...
Sorry?
that's not really what I meant, it's meat and potatoes. Yeah. But something to do with vegetables. Anyway, back at the passenger lounge, the Doctor and Mel are wondering who poisoned Hallett's coffee, and I suppose why Megarian would be ordering coffee in the first place and drinking it through a straw, which seems a bit odd to me. But the Doctor appears now, as he actually said in the courtroom, he's now ready to help and investigate and not stand on the sidelines anymore. He believes that Hallett left the Demeter seeds for him to find. And Mel says, yeah, well, that would have led you to the hydroponic centre. So they head off there.
Mm. Yeah, in the corridor, something's kind of banging against the sort of air conditioning ducting, isn't there? Sort of these big grills everywhere, isn't there? One of the security guards goes over to check what it is, but then Bruckner angrily... Oh, it's the one that's standing outside the door of the isolation chamber, isn't it? Mm. As soon as he steps away, Bruckner comes running out and has a go at him for leaving his post. He must have sort of had the door, you know, open a crack to start spying on him. As soon as he steps away, he comes running out.
Gotcha!
Yeah. And then we see Mel and the Doctor down in the cargo hold. And they're wondering about Hallett's Mayday call, why he called the Doctor in. Mel recites the Mayday message, doesn't she? She says, oh, I suppose the incomplete first word must have been imperative. What, really? What else could it have been? All those words ended in imperative.
Yes.
Good grief.
Clever piece of deduction.
Yeah, very good. The doctor compliments her on her ability to... She's apparently got the ability for total recall, so she's got a memory like an elephant. And Mel takes, doesn't take too kindly to being compared to an elephant, does she?
But she also says, quite naturalistically, compliments, you are undergoing a change.
Yeah, and then she says, oh, I do realise you're trying to take my mind off poor Edwards, and then completely changes her kind of attitude from really bubbly to looking a bit sad in the space of half a second.
Martin, that's musical theatre. That's how it works. You're lucky she wasn't swept along by a syrupy string section.
Sorry?
That's not slang for anything.
Okay. Sounded like it might be, but let's move on.
Yeah, so, the doctor's been claiming that Halleck wanted him there as a catalyst and to divert attention away from his own activities. The doctor produces a leaf that he got from Hallett's pocket without anybody seeing, when he was down there kind of taking the mask off and finding out that it was Halleck. He does a conjuring trick with this this leaf to show his sleight of hand and how he managed to get it off the corpse. This is done with elastic, apparently. Colin Baker doesn't possess the conjurer skills required for this, so this leaf was attached to elastic, which flies up his sleeve, apparently, when he wants the leaf to disappear.
I suppose you can still see it there, can't you?
You can, yeah, if you look carefully. It hasn't really disappeared. Anyway, the doctor then climbs into one of the empty man-sized vegetable pods and wonders what came out of it. And we kind of get the answer with another vervoid eye view, apparently moving through some of this air conditioning ducting, which never, ever gets used in Doctor Who, does it?
Oh, no, I thought that was a very clever, original idea, because I've never seen it before.
But then you do tend to...
It's a Doctor Who staple, isn't it? You have to have some sort of air duct at some point.
You have to get around a space station or base under siege in a way that no one knows how you're doing it unless they've watched an episode of Doctor Who.
Yep. Anyway, down in the gym, three scientists are back together, and they're having a big punch-up. Well, they're not, actually. Bruckner says they're on the brink of disaster. Isn't that the name of one of the first Doctor Who episodes?
Yes, they're beyond the sun and on the brink of disaster.
Darlin tells him to stop panicking, and he says their work must remain secret at all costs. Bruckner accuses him of not having any conscience. And Lasky says the results of their experiments are benign. Bruckner reminds her about the isolation room. So, obviously something in there isn't benign. but she says it was an unfortunate mishap bearing no relevance to the situation. And she questions Bruckner's loyalty, reminding him that they'd agreed to keep their discovery a secret until they reached Earth.
This whole scene is another example of dreadful dialogue.
This whole story is an example of dreadful dialogue.
But there's not, I don't think there's a single line in this scene that is remotely naturalistic.
Too right.
But, of course, at this moment, things get slightly more interesting in the fact that there's a vervoid eye view through the grill into the gym where they're having this discussion. And then we look back at the face from the other side of the grill, don't we? Which at this point looks like a couple of cauliflowers.
It does. The old chap, Mr. Kimber, he's going into his cabin for a rest. Janet stops him outside and she says she'll go and fetch him a hot drink to help him sleep.
A warm drink, which I thought was a very strange turn of phrase. You would think it would be a hot drink, but it's a warm drink. I can get you a tepid drink, if that sounds appetising.
Sounds lovely. Anyway, inside his room, there's a vervoid hiding in the bathroom.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and Mr. Kimber, he goes in and he opens the inner door and it zaps him in the neck with this kind of thorn thing that comes out of its hand, and he falls down with a little cry. And when Janet returns, she knocks on the door. There's no response. So she goes in and she assumes there's nobody there, so she assumes he must be in the bathroom. So she knocks on the door saying she's brought his drink. Doesn't get a response. The vervoid turns on the shower, doesn't he? And Janet assuming that Kim is having a shower, so he can't hear her, leaves the tray there and goes back out into the corridor.
See, I think that's unrealistic, because if she knew that Kimber was there in his birthday suit, she'd want to push that door open and have a little look, wouldn't she?
I'm not going to comment on that, actually, Jim.
Sorry, did I say that out loud? So, on to the next scene, quickly.
I think we should linger a bit and discuss what your brain is doing.
So, the doctor and Mel spot Lasky coming out of the isolation room wearing a surgical mask. Mel appears to hear a sound coming from the ducting. There's one of these quite tall grills quite nearby. But the doctor has got an idea of his own, and they're near a kind of fire point on the wall, so he takes the emergency axe from there and smacks it into the alarm there. So this alarm goes off, and the ever-busy mustachioed guard, who must be close to omnipresent, turns up in milliseconds from this alarm going off. And the doctor says, quickly, the lounge, there are passengers trapped. And so and he hands the axe to this guard, and he runs off to the lounge. The doctor grabs two oxygen masks, and he and Mel burst into the isolation room. It's kind of like a photographic darkroom, isn't it? There's a certain type of light in there, but he goes in and just presses the normal cabin lights on. They see a black sort of a kind of blackout oxygen tent, I guess, isn't it? They unzip it, and they see a sort of mutated half-woman, half-plant in there, which is quite grim, until she opens her eyes, and her face starts throbbing, which is very grim. All these sort of vein things start throbbing on her face. Mel screams. Don't even know why I needed to say that. as is common, there's a reaction shot of the doctor. This time he's in a gas mask, so there's not a lot of reaction to be gleaned.
His eyebrows raise a tad, but that's about it.
Yeah, he might have done that if Mel had broken wind.
Maybe she did. Maybe that was the cause of the raised eyebrow.
Maybe he was utterly untroubled by this throbbing mutant in front of him.
Well, that's not very nice thing to call Mel, is it?
Sorry. I should ratchet back on the Mel assassination. She's not a throbbing mutant. I don't know why I said that.
So, that's just unkind, yeah.
So that's the end of part two.
Yeah, so not quite as good an episode ending as the first one, but
well, pretty good one though. I mean, the effects are a little bit ropey, aren't they, for the veins? I think, but it's a shock. It's a nice.
Yeah,
shock.
It's a shock. It's I think it's quite good. I just I hate all those sort of close-ups of the doctor's face. That's the only thing.
Well, they do end up making every cliffhanger look the same, don't they? Except this time it's wearing a gas mask.
Anyway, this kind of human stroke plant sits up and reaches out an arm. And it seems to say, stop Lasky, doesn't it? Mm. At which point, the three scientists burst in. They manhandle the doctor and Mel out of the room. Lasky pushes the creature back down and places a mask over its face. And outside in the corridor, Dolan's pushing the doctor along, isn't he, and warning him that the guards will soon be back and will be even less pleased with him than he is. Mel is angrily asking about the monstrosity in the room. And the doctor asks if the Commodore knows what's going on in there. Dolan explains that it's actually Ruth Baxter, his lab assistant, and they're taking her to Earth to hopefully reverse what's happened to her. He says that their experiments involved some calculated risks, and during sort of a particularly delicate cross-pollination, a speck of pollen penetrated a scratch on her thumb, and this is the result.
So this particularly delicate cross-pollination, she wasn't wearing gloves.
Well, apparently not.
Or perhaps she's in a bikini as well.
Yeah, possibly. That's what I'd wear if I was doing it.
Well, I've seen you. I was physically sick.
Don't you like my cross-pollination, Jim?
It makes me retch like a dog.
Fair dues.
No offence.
Oh, none taken. Each to their own.
Good. Glad we can treat this kind of situation like adults.
Anyway, a guard turns up, probably with a moustache, but I can't vouch for it.
No, he was on his own.
He wasn't, he was with Rudge. So there was definitely one moustache. I think there was two.
Possibly two.
Anyway, they turn up and Mel comes out with another cracker. That guard looks trigger happy to me.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's starting to get laughable at this point. Rudge points out that setting up an alarm on this ship means he's under arrest and he's going to have to explain himself to the Commodore. And the Valiard calls for the Matrix to be stopped again, doesn't he?
Yeah, the Valiard's basically saying that all this does is point out that the Doctor's own defence is showing the Doctor's deliberately flouting authority. The Doctor basically tells him to suppress his bloodlust and wait to see how things unfold. So, yeah, we go back to the events on the Hyperion. On the bridge, Travers orders the ship to be taken closer still to the black hole. The Doctor's been taken to the bridge by now, hasn't he? Because he needs to be told off for hitting the fire alarm fraudulently, whatever the phrase is. The Doctor warns him of unexpected turbulence. Yeah, these black holes, you don't want to get too close because anything can happen, really. Travis says, when I want your advice, I'll ask for it. And he then goes on to berate him as if he were a small child for misusing the fire alarm. Then there's a brief scene in another corridor with Mel and Rudge. Janet arrives saying that Kimber is missing and he didn't show up for the fire alarm, you know, where everyone musters at a certain place. There was no sign of Kimber.
Mm. Mel's been listening to this conversation, hasn't she? And as Rudge and Janet leave, she goes into Kimber's room and she finds another of these leaves on the floor, doesn't she, in the bathroom. And then we see the dead bodies of one of the guards and Edwards, and they're kind of in the ducting, aren't they, in the air conditioning. And Kimber's body is being dragged along by two of these humanoid plant things, which we might as well start calling vervoids. Otherwise it's going to be very clumsy for the rest of this episode.
Yes.
So they drag Kimber's body in, and we finally get to see them up close, don't we, for the first time?
Up close and personal.
Mm. Care to describe them to us, Jim?
Yeah, it's a cross between a sort of brain, a sort of cauliflower, a sort of orchid, and a sort of a lady's front garden.
Yes.
Wouldn't
yes,
you say?
Yes.
There's a, I think what you would call a spray of flowers or stamens in a sort of, can I use the word gash, in the face of this creature? It's a kind of a vertical smile.
Yeah, well done. Let's move on.
joking aside, what do you think of these vervoids?
I think they're quite good, really. They're plant-like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they look okay, I think. The problem comes when they start talking a bit later on.
Yeah, that's dreadful. All I would say is I think I like the kind of all that kind of leaf, the sort of foliage stuff in them. I think
yeah,
it's good. And I like the idea of the sort of these brain-like things, because there's a lot of, in the more exotic plants, they're kind of brain-like things in them, aren't there? So I think it's quite a clever design. Unfortunately, as you pointed out a few podcasts ago, there aren't any good monsters during JNT's reign, are there?
Not really good. I mean, I think these are okay. I don't think they're awful by any means.
I suppose these and the pteroleptals are probably among the best ones. Unfortunately, all the monsters are made out of foam rubber. Aren't they, at this point in the show's history, and it just never looks convincing. I mean, it's, in this case, it's only the kind of faces, if you can call them that, of the vervoids, and the bodies look okay, I think. But as soon as you get foam rubber without any kind of, if you need...
Proper features, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
You're thinking about sort of draconians and things like that, which look quite good.
Yeah, I mean, the latex stuff is always more effective, I think, but this kind of sort of expanded rubber, so if it just looks like that, it just looks like expanded rubber, it never looks convincing.
No.
And it doesn't look convincing here either. What I would like to see is, you know, a little kind of a glaze of something over something to make it look moist, or it just looks like dry foam rubber, doesn't it? Like so many of the monsters do during this era.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree with you. I think as foam rubber monsters go, these are reasonably good.
Yeah, as I say, they're amongst the best of J&T's era, I would say. But when you compare it to anything by John Friedlander, which is unfair because he was the best. I guess it's unfair because he was the best monster designer the show's ever seen. But, you know, the materials he used are still available because they're available in the 70s. So I'd much rather that kind of sculptured approach with a latex skin over it, which I believe is how he used to do this stuff, than however they do this stuff. But, I mean, the design is good. I mean, some plants are, you know, quite nauseating to look at, aren't they, some of the exotic ones. Mm. And this, you know, the design has been taken from those type of plants, which I think is a great idea. But it's just the actual execution. It's that kind of just dry foam rubber stuff. And you get the feeling that if you, you know, rip the back of your sofa, you'd see something not wildly dissimilar to that.
Could hope not.
It might not kill you with a poison thorn, if you're lucky.
Well, I won't rip it off, just in case. There's no point taking the risk, really, is there?
No, never mind the marital strife it would entail.
Not to mention a new sofa.
Yeah, that too. So, back on the bridge, the doctor tells Travers that he knows that Travers has been using him. Travers has already asked the authorities what Hallett's mission was, but it's top secret and they won't tell him. By the time clearance on that is given, the ship will have already docked. But Travers has said that no one, including the murderer, will be allowed off at that point. You know, they'll just seal the ship and get the investigators on. The doctor runs off and asks Travers to tell him as soon as he gets a reply from the authorities as to what Hallett's mission was. And Travers says, as the doctor leaves, "Yes, I'll match you for candor." Which, it sounds like a crossword clue more than a line of real dialogue.
Hmm. Elsewhere, Rudge tells Janet that he can't find Kimber. And then the Megarians stop Rudge and they want to know what's happening. He assures them that the alarm that they heard was a false one. And he tries to leave, but they insist. And they're quite threatening, aren't they? And they say he must tell them everything. And you kind of get the impression here that they've got something over him, don't they?
Yeah. First time. But if you look at this scene in the light of what's revealed later on, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Doesn't it? Why not?
Because they're treating him like a stranger.
No, I didn't think they were treating him like a stranger. I thought they were asking him to update them on what's going on because, you know, they're working together.
Yeah, but I think the way it's shown is as if he doesn't really know them. If they are working together, they would know all this already. He would have told them.
Mm.
That's how I look at it. I don't think the scene's at all convincing once you know what their relationship is. Because he's trying to get away from them, isn't he? He doesn't want to answer their questions. Whereas,
that's true. That doesn't make much sense.
If they're in league with each other, he would be telling them.
Yeah, I suppose it shouldn't be there, really, should it?
No.
It's just there to put you further off the scent.
Yeah, it's there to put you off the scent, but it's again one of those scenes, once you know it's the truth, you look back at it, it makes absolutely no sense.
Mm.
It's just cheating. It's lazy, and it's lazy script writing.
It shouldn't be allowed.
Anything, you should be able to watch anything twice, and everything should still work.
Yeah, definitely. We then see the chief guard, and he sees one of these grills rattling, and he opens it, and is attacked and zapped by the verboids.
Zapped in the verboids?
I think it was a neck, actually.
Oh, God.
So at least one of these mustachioed chief guards has now been zapped.
So only 7 to go.
Yeah. But as he falls down, he manages to hit his communicator, doesn't he? Mm. And on the bridge, the Commodore hears the verboids speaking. One of them says, "Help me with this." And Travers asks his subordinate to trace that call.
So, yes, in the hydroponic centre, Doland discovers Bruckner in the cubicle, shredding all the papers that they've been working on. And he's aghast at this, and he reminds him that it really doesn't have any right to do that. It's not just Bruckner's work that Bruckner's destroying, it's everybody's. But Bruckner clearly he's been a little bit like a cat on a hot tin roof throughout, hasn't he? But he's had enough now with the news of Kimber going missing. You know, he's just like, yeah, this is a harmless old man. Don't you think things have gone too far? So he carries on shredding, and Dolan sort of backs out and locks him in this cubicle. Meanwhile, in the gym, Mel has asked Lasky what the leaf that she found in Kimber's, the ducting in the Kimber's shower room. But she's clearly stalling about it. She said, I'm not going to answer any questions until I finish my workout. Meanwhile, Doland arrives and tells Lasky that she needs to go to talk to Bruckner because Bruckner won't listen to him. So Lasky finishes her workout and storms out angrily. But Mel, unrealistically, I think, stops Doland on his way out, hoping for more explanations because he started explaining about his lab assistant getting zapped and she thinks he's in the mood to spill some more beans. He fobs her off, saying that the pods that she saw contained fruits which they left on Mogar. So they just basically took these the husks that were remaining back. They're taking them back to Earth to show to scientists there. He leaves and Mel hears some noises coming from the air ducting. So there's a grill above these sort of climbing bars in the gym, and she nips up with quite some speed, doesn't she, up these wall bars, and looks through the grill. And then she drops down and gets some of these headphones and climbs back up again, because these headphones are those ones that got a mic attached to them. So she puts the microphone arm into this grill, jumps down and goes into the booth and listens in. This is where it all goes wrong. She hears a verboid saying, "We must not make animal kind aware of our existence. They still outnumber us. If we are to kill them all, we must hunt them down secretly." Which is a bit scary if you're part of the animal kingdom, such as humans. But a white-gloved hand appears and puts her gas mask over Mel's face, and she screams. No real surprise there.
The doctor enters the lounge to find it empty. So he goes to look for Mel in the gym. But we see Mel, and she's unconscious in a laundry bin. Someone covers her with a towel and closes the lid and disappears. And the laundry man more or less immediately appears with another, pushing another bin through the door. And then he removes the one that's got Mel in it. The doctor arrives shortly afterwards, and he holds the door open to this laundry man, doesn't he? And makes an extremely feeble joke about wishing that he could lose his waist so easily. The man ignores him, unsurprisingly.
As all right-minded people would.
Well, most right-minded people would punch him in the face and then just walk off.
I was just thinking of right-minded people punching random people in the face. That's a definition of right-minded people that I was hitherto unaware of.
Well, in my book, that's what should have been done. The doctor goes to the sound booth and he sees that the record button is still on, so he plays back the tape and he hears the verboid's voice. But he also then hears Mel's scream and then his own voice talking to the bin man. So he rushes off and he asks Janet where the waste bins go. She tells him that it's the pulverizer, so he legs it. And we see Mel's bin being taken to the waste disposal place. And just as the man who's emptying these bins is about to throw Mel into the pulverizer, the doctor arrives and stops him. And he opens the lid, takes the towel from over Mel, who's at this stage is just coming round, and says, "Don't throw the towel in, Mel."
Tumbleweed, anyone? I don't think this is a particularly green organisation, despite the verboids. I mean, you wouldn't get Travelodge burning their towels in the bin used once, would you?
That's true, but maybe they looked inside. They would have taken it to the to the laundry room to be washed, but they looked inside, saw that there was a dead body, and they thought, "Oh, I'll just take that as a pulveriser."
Yeah. Well, it's hard to wash dead bodies, isn't it?
It is, yes.
You never know what setting to put on or how much conditioner to use.
Yeah, there's no point really because they start to smell anyway. So.
They're going to ruin the laundry one way or another.
Exactly.
Yes. Anyway, back to the bridge. Travis is ranting at Rudge again for not telling him about the disappearance of Kimber. He says to him, "As a security officer, you're an unmitigated disaster." Yeah, that would ruin your day.
How to motivate your staff.
Yes. I think there were some shortfalls in your performance today. And I think we should just grab a coffee, you know, very informally, and just talk them through. No, he doesn't use that approach, perhaps quite wisely. Then we see the Verboid's compost heap, and Moustache Guard has his body dumped onto the pile. And there are five Verboids standing about. One says, I think rather quaintly, we are doing splendidly. I don't claim to know anything about the vocabulary of plants, but splendidly seems a bit unusual or unexpected at the very least.
It's brilliant. We're doing splendidly. Now that is comedy.
Unintentional comedy.
Pure comedy. Well done, Pip and Jane. You got it right for once.
If you did but know it. Anyway, the way they word it is a bit odd, isn't it? The plan is to fill this area with bodies, isn't it?
Yeah.
That isn't really the plan, is it? The plan is to kill everybody, and as a result, that area will be filled with bodies.
Yeah.
But the way they say it, you think, is there something important about filling that area with bodies?
But one of them, in a hilarious voice, says, the congratulations must be delayed until that is full. And I just wrote a note against that saying he never worked again. It's just terrible.
You may be right.
I don't know what kind of accent it is, but it's hilarious.
Yeah, it's kind of cod, sort of hissing voice, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they've all got slightly different accents to each other, and none of them sound convincing. You know, as we discuss in the Seeds of Doom podcast, it's a mistake to let plants talk.
True.
Who knows what a plant's voice is supposed to be like?
That's true. Maybe if all plants talk, they talk like that. But,
it's left only to conjecture.
Anyway, the Doctor and Mel return to the sound room, but the tape has been removed, and they wonder again about the killer. Mel suggests that it could be a woman, Lasky, or even Janet. Then they're back in the gym. They climb up the rungs to the grill above, you know, above those climbing rungs sort of thing. And kind of ponder what these Vervoids actually are. The Doctor decides that it's about time he had a look down in the hydroponics centre, and he suggests that maybe Janet might know where the tape is, so suggests Mel go and have a word with her. Up in the lounge, Janet offers the Mogarians a coffee. One of them says no thanks, and the other one knocks the tray from her hands. The bastard.
Yeah, that's nice, isn't it?
What did the lovely Janet ever do to him?
Well, not enough, apparently. She says, not to worry, it's easily changed. What is easily changed?
Don't know. The floor tiling?
But you get, I mean, the next scene is Mel in Janet's cabin, and you think she means it's her outfit is easily changed because the Megarian has spilt coffee on it. So you then expect Mel to be discovered in Janet's cabin by Janet. That doesn't happen.
No.
So, what is the point of that scene?
No point. There is no point.
There is no point. Carry on.
And then we see the communications room being smashed to smithereens by a really happy-looking doctor holding an axe.
He does look a trifle gleeful, doesn't he?
He does. And, of course, unsurprisingly, we come back to the courtroom at this point. And the doctor very indignantly saying, I didn't do that. And he denies it was him. And I think the Valar says, well, who was it then? And he says, it was the murderer. And he says again that the Matrix is wrong. It's been changed. The Inquisitor asks if there's any point in continuing if he doubts the veracity of what they're seeing. But, of course, he has no choice. And they have to continue. I think this is a bit of a stupid thing to do by the... As we find out in the next story by the Valyard, don't you? Because it's obviously not what the Doctor would do.
Well, yeah, both the scenes that appear to have been substituted in are not a very undoctorish.
Well, I mean, the first one is a bit more subtle, though, isn't it? It's like he didn't stop her from going down to the hydroponic centre on her own, which, you know, I mean, that, on the face of it, you could say that that's a possibility. But this isn't a possibility, is it?
Not at all. No, what, yeah, there's absolutely no way he would do this. I mean, the Baleo's not as clever as he thinks he is. You know, not giving anything away for the next two episodes. But, you're right. It's all wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to do that. Because all it does, really, is it just brings up again the fact that the Matrix can be changed, manipulated.
Yeah, it basically almost confirms that, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Saying, all right, well, now we know that the Matrix is being falsified. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's just a massive strategic blunder by the Baleol.
I think so.
But, I mean, I suppose the Inquisitor says at the end of the scene that, yeah, we've noticed again that once again you've sent a companion into danger, but, yeah, that's a big risk to take just to get her to think that, isn't it?
It is, especially considering what happens at the end of this story, assuming that the Valiard knows what happens because he's already seen the evidence. What is the point of doing it? Because, you know, as we find out, maybe we talk about it more at the end, but you know what happens at the end. So knowing that in advance, there's no point in trying to try and show that the Doctor's even worse than he is.
Exactly. Yeah. In the big twist at the end. This is just a footnote, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And pointless to give another indication that someone's been tampering with the Matrix when it's not even required to do that.
Mm.
Anyway, in Janet's cabin, Mel is kind of looking through it, and this is, you know, where that scene may have made some sense if Janet had turned up and, you know, found Mel in there. But as it turns out, it's a Vervoid that we see the doorknob turning and a Vervoid comes in. Travers then discovers the wrecked communications room. It's completely beyond repair, as it would be if someone had wielded an axe on it. But, you know, so basically they're completely isolated. So, you know, the only resources they have are, you know, the people that are on their side on this ship. In the hydroponics centre cubicle, Lasky's fuming about the burnt papers. Clearly, Bruckner's not only shredding but burning. She and Bruckner have a heavily padded argument about progress and, you know, the inevitable negative reactions from some parties to that progress. There's a Vervoid listening in at this point. And then Bruckner comes to realisation that any people who know about the discovery that they, this scientific team, have made are on this ship. So he then grabs something, you don't see what, but he hits Lasky with it and knocks her out. And heads off. You see the Doctor just ambling into the cargo hold. And then Bruckner absolutely rushes past him at breakneck speed, doesn't he? And just pushes past him and runs off. And this is a nice line, I think. This is perhaps my favourite line of the whole thing. The Doctor just looks wide-eyed and said, "I didn't even hear the dinner gong." No?
You liked that, did you?
I thought it was funny, yeah.
I thought that was the worst line in this entire script.
Honestly?
Yes. It's just rubbish.
Oh, I thought it was funny. I do find that kind of thing amusing. You know, people...
Why?
Well, it would take another podcast to explain. I don't know. Just no one is going to do it. It's the absurdity of it. No one's going to go that mental. We're asked by your top speed to barge into you to get to dinner first. So that's why I found it funny. And it's not even in the script, apparently. So I don't know if that's Baker's line or not.
Yeah. I thought it was awful, to be honest.
Well, just consider the fact that I think it's probably the best line in the script, and it wasn't written by Pip and Jane Baker.
Okay, well, we'll have to agree to disagree on that one, but I thought it was terrible. But
well, I laughed at that one. The only time I laughed in the right place.
Yeah.
But anyway, just to finish the scene off, the Vervoid sees the Doctor and rushes off to his air-conditioned lair. And the Doctor finds Lasky unconscious.
Yeah, then we see the Vervoids talking amongst themselves. They're saying that they must stop Bruckner. They are unique, and if he destroys them, the Vervoids will cease to exist. I think they refer to themselves then as Vervoids for the first time.
Which is odd, isn't it? Because later on, the Vervoids is a name that someone else has made up for them.
Is it?
I think Doland calls them that.
Okay. Yeah.
I might be wrong, but that's my memory of it.
So Bruckner's death is now their priority. He cannot be allowed to prevent us from reaching planet Earth.
Mm.
We see Bruckner knocking out a guard with a karate chop and taking his gun, don't we?
Does he shout, "Hi!" when he's doing it?
He doesn't, no.
Oh.
He doesn't twirl his cape either. And Lasky's come round, hasn't she? And she's denying that she knows anything about this tape that the doctor's talking about. He says she's a misguided scientist whose pursuit of the truth is an excuse for immoral experiments. But she kind of pops him off, saying, you know, Bruckner's demented and he's out to destroy the ship and everybody on it, so, you know, we need to deal with him. Now we see Bruckner again. He's attacked by Vervoid in the corridor, isn't he? But he manages to slam a grill on it and leg it off down the corridor.
Mm.
And again, we see the Vervoid in Janet's cabin. It seems to be smashing up the room, doesn't it, while Mel's hiding in the bathroom.
Mm. She's probably having a little wee in the shower.
She might be. Well, I don't know.
She's probably scared.
Yeah, maybe a little bit slipped out.
It happens. So let's not pretend it doesn't.
You're not taking your tablets, Jim?
No, I wear Depend for men, so if it happens to me, I'm fine.
You just tighten the strings at the bottom of your trousers.
Yep, that'll do me. It keeps a ferret in as well.
Moving on.
So the Doctor and Lasky find the unconscious guard that Bruckner attacked on his blundering way through the ship. And then we go to the bridge where Bruckner has arrived. He shoots Travers' hand as Travers is reaching, presumably for some kind of panic button. There's this silent, weirdy, beardy bloke, isn't there? Have you noticed him, Martin?
Yeah, he's kind of like the pilot, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a bloke with a massive beard. Absurdly big beard, really. Particularly for the future, where beards are outlawed.
Moustaches only.
Yeah. We have no place for beards. That kind of perversion. But yeah, apparently this bloke was originally, this character was originally going to have some dialogue, but to save money, they made it a non-speaking role. So this weirdy bearded bloke does quite a lot of stuff, and sometimes quite frenetically, but never speaks.
So is he a mute?
Yeah, he's like a mute.
Mm.
Yeah. So Bruckner orders Travers and this silent weirdy bearded bloke out of the bridge and locks the door behind them. So he's on his own in the bridge there, and he sets a course directly for the black hole of Tartarus.
That's not going to be good, is it?
No, that's going to smart when they enter the event horizon.
Mm. Outside the door, Travers orders the beardy man to go and get the laser lance, at which point the Doctor and Lasky arrive. The Doctor says Bruckner's determined to destroy the ship, and Lasky says that he's a trained astronaut. They needed one on their mission. You know, one of the crew had to be an astronaut. We see Bruckner at the controls, and the ship starting to head into the black hole. The Commodore says the bridge is hijack-proof, but it's just been hijacked. So that clearly is a pointless line.
Well, yeah, I mean, the line about that is that they can't externally turn the power off to the bridge because, you know, the designers thought it was hijack-proof. It ain't. But they can't turn the power off to it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the cabin, the Vervoid starts to emit a strange kind of gas from its mouth, doesn't it?
Mm.
That isn't explained at all.
No.
I'm not really sure why it does it.
Well, on the one hand, it looks like it's an involuntary thing. When you first see it, you think it's getting shaken up by the turbulence on the ship.
Yeah.
And you get the feeling it's something it doesn't want to do, but it's just kind of happening. It's like a kind of panic thing, and it's emitting this gas. But later on, it appears to be, you know, quite a conscious act, doesn't it? But it's never really explained, you know, which, is it?
It isn't.
And more to the point, apparently the actor inside the Vervoid costume, this smoke generator that they put in there wasn't plumbed correctly, and the whole suit and mask filled with this smoke.
God.
And they had to drag this dancer, because they're all trained dancers, these Vervoids.
Yeah.
They had to drag him out of this suit, and apparently Colin Baker had to give him mouth-to-mouth.
He was the only one that had the necessary skills.
He's got the biggest lungs, Colin Baker.
Ah, is that what it is? Mm. Lucky man. So the...
What? Lucky for who?
All involved.
Yeah, let's just leave it at that. Carry on, quickly.
So the ship's closing in on the black hole, and Bruckner rises to his feet, doesn't he? Sort of open mouthed, looking a bit like, what have I done?
Yeah, but I kind of thought he's in awe, isn't he? He's kind of looking.
He is a bit in awe, yeah.
Awe at the black hole of Tartarus.
Hmm. And I think it's quite good actually, because you get this black hole. It's got kind of a red effect around it, hasn't it? For some reason, even though it's a black hole.
It's not a red hole. That's far more biological.
And you get the kind of reflection of that on his face, don't you, as he's kind of looking with this open mouthed, strange expression.
Yeah, that bit is good. The black hole is crap.
Yeah, the black hole's crap, given. You know, I didn't think I needed to say that.
Sorry.
But, I quite like the reflection on his face. I'm clutching at straws here, Jim, as you know.
Mm.
Looking for some good amongst the god-awfulness.
The turgid desert of god-awfulness.
Yeah. Outside, the Commodore says this sort of juddering could be turbulence. And the Doctor sort of spells out exactly what's happening. He says, Bruckner is flying the ship into the eye of the black hole of Tartarus. And that's the episode ending. But we knew that anyway, because we've just seen it.
Exactly. I've just written down here, yeah, we know. That was pointed out a couple of minutes earlier, that is what's happening. So that is not a cliffhanger. The cliffhanger is that he is doing it.
Yeah.
The cliffhanger is not the Doctor telling everyone else he's doing it. It's too after the fact, isn't it?
Mm.
It's a crap cliffhanger.
It is pretty bad. It's a pretty good episode ending, apart from that.
Yeah.
It's just got this unnecessary bit tagged on the end. Anyway, into part 12.
Yes, or part 4 of Terror of the Vervoids. So, yeah, at the beginning of part 4, the other Vervoids are kind of smoking as well, aren't they? Not cigarettes, that would be stupid. But they're all emitting this smoke. And they're all heading to the bridge to stop Bruckner. That's kind of their prime directive at the moment, obviously, because they need to get to Earth. The one in Janet's cabin crawls out through the grill in the ensuite shower room. Manages to miss Mel somehow. I mean, she's behind the shower curtain, but he can't sniff her out. She runs out choking from the smoke that's being produced, so clearly what is coming out is not particularly pleasant for humans to breathe.
Meanwhile, the Doctor's helping the bearded crewman with the laser lance, and they're setting out to try and cut through the door to the bridge. The Vervoids can see Bruckner through one of the ventilation grills, can't they? But they don't appear to be able to get in. And then outside, the laser lance has done its job. This crewman, he kind of punches out the lock, doesn't he?
Which must be very, very hot at this point.
Yeah, he looks like he doesn't really want to do it, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, he's a non-speaking role. Yeah. He's not getting paid much.
Yeah, he can't even cry out. We cut. So he punches out this lock, and a load of this gas starts pouring out, doesn't he? And they all start coughing, and the crewman kind of fills the hole with a cloth, doesn't he, to block this gas.
Mm.
And inside, Bruckner falls to the floor with the gas all around it. Lasky says that this gas is a sort of a methane derivative, and that gas masks are going to be useless. And the Doctor and the Commodore, they argue about who's going to go in and risk their life to put the ship back on course.
These gas masks,
mm.
Why are they inadequate? For marsh gas. I can't remember whether they got a little oxygen supply to them or not, but you know, I'd be first to admit I don't know anything about marsh gas, but if it's some kind of natural gas, surely whatever gas mask you have on this futuristic space vessel are going to be able to cope with that. I mean, this is just a contrivance for the sake of this next scene, isn't it? Surely.
Yeah, it does seem a bit of a contrivance. There's some gas. How are we going to get past it? Well, put on a gas mask, obviously. I hadn't really thought that much about it, but you're right, it is a contrivance.
But it leads to a key scene, but yeah, that's what contrivances do.
This is true.
Yeah, so Rudd says, come to the bridge, into his communication. These two Megarians enter the bridge. That's a quite major camera wobble going on here to show the turbulence of being that close to the black hole of Tartarus. But they sit down at the controls, and they you can see that they've changed the course past the black hole, and they manage to kind of veer past it and goes off our screen as a viewer. And they turn and nod to each other, don't they? Quite. But the air is breathable now on the bridge. You know, the normal air conditioning of the Hyperion is now kind of kicked in and pumped all that kind of crap out. And the Megarians are now outside there with Travers and the Doctor and the rest of them. And Travers kind of thanks him very much and says that now that the bridge is clear, he'll resume command, you know, as the Commodore. But Security Officer Rudge pulls a gun on him and he tells him that he and the Megarians are in league and they're hijacking the ship. The Doctor can't believe this. He knows the Megarians. He knows they're a peaceful race. Any kind of violence is abhorrent to them. But they say that, well, that doesn't matter because no one will be harmed if they cooperate with them, which is a little bit feeble, because if they don't cooperate, then presumably they'll use violence, which is repugnant. It doesn't really work. But anyway, yeah, it gets a bit personal, doesn't it, between Travers and Rudge. Travers starts having a go at Rudge. Rudge says, "All my life, someone like you has been patronizing me, treating me with contempt. Well, I'd welcome the opportunity for settling the score." So he's a long time serving security officer who's fed up with people having a crack at him. And we find out there's a little bit more in it for him, you know, other than just settling the score with his superiors. Anyway, the Megarian kind of sees that he's a bit of a loose cannon and tells him to take the hostages to the passenger lounge.
Yes, in the lounge, Dolan's there with Janet, OET, and as the Doctor and party are walking along the corridor, they kind of run into Mel, but the Doctor stops Rudge before he can see her, doesn't he? And he kind of waves her away, and he says something to make it clear to her that they've been hijacked. So Mel legs it off down the corridor, and she goes into the lounge and warns Dolan and Janet, you know, about what's going on. And they kind of run out of another door, which is kind of closing already, isn't it, for some bizarre reason?
Yeah.
And they kind of go out as the others all come in. And then Raj asks the Commodore for the keys to the vault. He refuses and starts to walk away. And Raj, in a very old man way, karate chops him, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, luckily, Travers is an old man as well, otherwise it would be utterly unconvincing.
Anyway, Raj is holding the gun on the others, and he tells Lasky to get the keys from the Commodore.
From his pocket? Oh, God!
Pussy Have I rummaged around in his pants pocket?
Pussy galore, rummaging around your pants pocket.
Blimey. Tea time TV.
Yeah. They got away with so much in the 80s.
He says that the Megarians want the precious metals that they believe have been plundered from their planet. Lasky throws the keys over to Rudge. He says that his motive is pride, as well as a bit of greed. That's effectively what he says, isn't it?
Essentially, yeah.
He says he was being put out to grass after all these years. This voyage was going to be his last. I didn't realise that, did you?
No, well, they only said it about 14 times, so...
So he decided he was going to arrange a more comfortable retirement for himself.
But the Doctor tries to warn him that the Verboids are a greater menace. But Rose doesn't care. In less than an hour, they'll have rendezvoused with their pickup. So Mel, Janet and Doland are running down a corridor, which is unusual for this story, when they hear a Megarian over the tannoy announcing that they've taken over. Any attempt by the remaining humans to approach the bridge or passenger lounge will result in the death of the hostages. So Mel runs to the communications room to radio for help, but she finds that the sabotage that we saw earlier, and she goes back and tells the others. Dolan wonders whether Janet can organise the guards to mount an attack on the passenger lounge with the hostages in it, but she's worried that any attack will result in those hostages getting murdered. Mel wonders if they can actually warn the hostages about the attack without their captors knowing about it. So she opens up a nearby grill and goes into the ducting.
Dangerous, you'd think, wouldn't you?
You would think that. Ill-advised.
The Doctor and Travers think that Rudge isn't Rudge that's behind these murders. We see Mel walking through the ducting. And then on the bridge, we see the Megarians turn and speak to someone. They say, what are you doing here? We didn't ask for refreshments. And the person throws liquid in their faces and they scream and fall to the floor, clutching their face masks, don't they? So Mel arrives at the ventilation grill that's above the lounge where the doctor's handily sitting. and she calls through to him.
Yeah, to be fair, he likes to sit near these grills because he likes the wind blowing through his lovely yellow golden hair.
Anyway, he very unsurreptitiously stands and speaks to her.
What's that you said, Mel? I can't hear you. Speak up.
It's not obvious at all that he's talking to someone, is it? So Mel tells him about this planned attack on the lounge and to, when they hear the fire alarm, get everybody to dive for cover. The doctor says, no, no, it's too risky. Attack the bridge and get out of the air duct quickly.
So we're back in the air conditioning ducts and the verboids are ludicrously swaying about. They're remarking the fact that human beings tend to kill each other and they have no respect for any form of life. They decide to resume the hunt. Back on the bridge, Mel, Janet and Doland have found the dead Megarians, you know, killed by the fluid that was chucked in their faces. Doland believes that Rudge has to be convinced that the hijack's a lost cause for him to stand down, basically. Mel thinks that these Megarian faceplates are going to help in that cause, so she takes one off to reveal a human who's been sprayed gold with sort of grill sellotaped over his mouth. I can understand why the helmet might have a grill in it. Why would the actual face of the being inside have a sort of flesh grill on its mouth? Does that make any sense to you?
No.
Why can't it just have a face? Grill is.
Why can't it just have a face?
Yeah, I may be the first person in the history of the world who said, why can't it just have a face?
So one of the vervoids goes into the isolation room and finds the half-human, half-vegetable Ruth Baxter, pulls back the sort of black tent thing. She screams and it zaps her with, you know, with its zapping hand. That to me just felt a bit strange because it's kind of like half a vervoid and probably turning into a vervoid.
Yeah, you wouldn't. That wouldn't be first on your list as a vervoid to kill, would it?
No. They were just having a go at the humans for killing themselves, and they've more or less just done that.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, they just clearly wanted it out of the plot, and that's how they decided to do it, because I guess no human would have done it. So, it doesn't make any sense. And neither does the way that this vervoid staggers about.
Yeah, that's true.
Why does it have to move around like that?
It's just really jerky movements.
Yeah. It's been injected with pure vodka or something.
Maybe. Back in the lounge, Mel, Doland and Janet, they can knock and come in, don't they? And they show Rudge the Megarian faceplates to convince him they're dead. Doland drops the faceplates on the floor, and as Rudge looks down, he knocks his gun. He knocks it out of his hand, and it flies across and is caught by the Commodore, isn't it?
Could happen.
And Rudge throws the keys on the floor and runs away, quite comically.
It's like
exactly.
A peek. He throws the keys on the floor.
Yeah. The bearded crewman makes as if to follow him, but the Commodore tells him to leave him to the cards.
To be honest, I wish you'd use the correct terminology. Weirdy, beardy, silent bloke.
Yes, sorry. I should have done. I will do next time.
Yeah.
He tells him to get back to the bridge, because presumably nobody's been driving this ship for quite a while.
Yeah, it's probably gone back into the black hole by now, but that was...
Yeah, just... probably came out the other side.
Into a new world.
The Commodore calls for answers from Lasky and the Doctor, doesn't he? And the Doctor, at this point, he scribbles a little note on a notepad and he requests permission to go and search all the cabins for the stolen tape. And he also asks the Commodore for a phaser. And as the Commodore hands him Rudge's gun, he passes the Commodore this note.
Surely this phaser's come from the Starship Enterprise, hasn't it?
Yeah, it could well have done.
That's the first time that the word phaser has been used in Doctor Who.
Yeah, it probably is.
Why would you use the name of a gun in another highly, if not more, popular science fiction series. We've had stasers on Gallifrey and all sorts of lasers. Just leave phaser alone. Don't use that one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because they haven't been, you know, they've just been referred to as guns, haven't they, until this point?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
All right, so Mel is astonished, well, for two reasons, that the Doctor asks for a phaser, not to do with Star Trek, but the fact that he's, you know, doesn't use guns, and also that he told everybody about the gym sound booth tape. He explains the gun by saying exceptional circumstances require exceptional measures, and his public announcement about the tape seems to be intentional. He says he intends to take up the role of Judas Goat again. Anyway, he asks Mel where she thinks Lasky would hide the tape. She starts by saying a cabin, but then thinks again, really, and says no, it'll be a gym locker. So they head off to the gym.
Meanwhile, in the corridors, Rudge is running around and eventually gets zapped by the Vervoids. And then we see the Doctor searching Dolan's cabin. Dolan comes in and calmly assures the Doctor that he won't find the tape there. And he asks him what he's accused of. And the Doctor says, well, murder. And he says that he's narrowed the suspects down to just two, Dolan and Lasky. Dolan says, well, he knows that he's innocent, and he can't believe that Lasky would murder anybody. But he does know somewhere where she keeps things. And the Doctor follows him out of the room. And then we see Mel searching Lasky's locker in the gym, and she's caught by Lasky. She's not too pleased about that either, is she? Mel gives some feeble excuse about being interested in the design of Lasky's tracksuit as an excuse for nosing around in her locker. Yeah, pretty feeble in the extreme, really.
Extremely. Lasky doesn't buy this, of course, and guesses that she's looking for this gym tape. Back in the hydroponic centre, the cubicle in there, the Doctor is trying to open a locked drawer there. Dolan is with him, and he says that Lasky is the only key to this drawer, but the Doctor pulls this electronic device from his capacious pockets and clamps it onto the drawer, and it opens it. Because at this point, he's still not using his sonic screwdriver, is he?
No.
I think it doesn't appear until the TV movie, does it? I think from the Visitation.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Yeah, I think from Visitation to TV movie, I don't think we see it. However, you know how the story goes. Stupidly, the Doctor puts the gun down right in front of Dolan and then searches the open drawer with both hands. Dolan then produces a bow tie-shaped mini-disc, which is the tape that they're after, and throws it to the Doctor. And it's one of those things, you know, he throws it at the Doctor, the Doctor hasn't got his hands free, and then grabs the gun. But to be honest, it was right next to me, he could have grabbed it any time he wanted. Dolan says, yeah, don't worry about this tape, I've wiped it already, it's no use to you. And the Doctor says, well, I thought you might have. He says Dolan was his prime suspect. The first murder needed access to this hydroponics unit. The second needed access to poison. And the attempt on Mel's life needed unchallenged access to the isolation room to get hold of the anaesthetic that he used on her so he could get her in the laundry bin. Well, Dolan quite reasonably says, well, Lasky could have done all of this. But the Doctor points out, yes, except for the fact that she was hostage when the Megarians were killed. So Dolan says, all right, well, if you think I've done it, then what's my motive? The Doctor suggests jealousy, professional envy, and then says, well, it's more likely to be plain avarice. This bit doesn't work, I don't think, unless I've missed something. Well, he says, wow, well, if you think that, then you're not as astute as you think. The Vervoids represent a vast economic power, if you can get them back to Earth. They can run the factories and farms at practically no cost. All they need is sunlight and water, so they're cheaper than the robots that they currently use. He's got the financial backing of a consortium, you know, to get the logistics of all this into place. But surely that is avarice, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
If you're making money out of the Vervoids, then that is the plain avarice that the Doctor thought was the most likely explanation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's another example of crap script writing.
That's right. We see a Vervoid outside, don't we? And it's obviously listening to all of this as well. The Doctor accuses Dolan of using them as slave labour. And at this point, Dylan's kind of had enough, and he tries to shoot the Doctor with the phaser that he's picked up, but it won't work. And the Doctor says that he took the liberty of disarming it. And Dolan starts to back out of the cabin. But as he turns to sort of leg it away, he runs straight into the Commodore and the guards. And the Doctor says, yeah, and I also took the precaution of taking the Commodore into my confidence. And the Commodore orders him thrown into the brig.
Yeah, that's not the Brigadier. Let's be straight. That wouldn't be right.
No, it wouldn't be.
Throwing someone into him. So, the Vervoids have dumped Rudge onto their human compost heap, and they say that Doland will soon be joining him. Doland is being pushed down a corridor by a guard. A Vervoid leaps out of the grating and thorns the guard.
Nasty.
Doland chooses this opportunity to escape, only to turn around a corner and be surrounded by four more Vervoids. He then starts begging for his life, basically, and saying that the Vervoids wouldn't exist without him, and that he is their friend. And he thinks he's about to shake the hand of one of these Vervoids, doesn't he? He starts sort of grinning and laughing, sort of hysterically, doesn't he? But as this Vervoid shakes his hand, it thorns him in the hand, and he collapses.
In disbelief. So, back on the bridge, the Commodore wants to know how they're going to defeat the Vervoids. Lasky reckons something's gone wrong with their DNA, but the Doctor thinks that it's something more fundamental than that. He says that their plants and all animals consume plants at some stage. Basically, it's kill or be killed, really. We get an awful bit of acting from Otto Blackman saying that, oh, I must have been blinded by professional vanity. I mean, it's one of those under-liberal lines again, I think.
It's not her fault. That's just what an awful line. It's the kind of thing you might, like in a historical thing, say someone was blinded by professional vanity. No one is going to say that about themselves. It's awful.
It is awful. And they figure out it's going to be impossible for them to coexist, the humans and the Vervoids. The Commodore wants the Doctor's undivided commitment to help them defeat the Vervoids. And we taken back to the courtroom, the Doctor stabs the stop button, doesn't he? And he jumps up and says he was presented with an appeal from the man in authority. He did not meddle. And that's why, that's basically his case there and then.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a bit feeble, I think.
But nevertheless, he looks smugger even than he did before.
Yeah, if that's possible. The Inquisitor accepts this argument, doesn't she, and says that, even the Valiard can't refute it. But the Valiard just sort of says, well, let's wait and see what happens. And they continue.
Yes. In the hydroponics cubicle, Lasky finds there's virtually no herbicide left. The Doctor strokes his cat badge rather annoyingly. I think I hate all that stuff.
Yeah.
Cat badge and celery and all that rubbish. He asks... Cool men on the curmudgeon. The Doctor asks Lasky whether the Vervoid chloroplasts function normally, in the way that normal chloroplasts do. She says that they do, i.e. they trap sunlight, for the use of photosynthesis. But some Vervoids turn up, blocking the only exit, it seems. Lasky decides to go and reason with these plant men. The Doctor warns her against it. But she believes that the Vervoids will know that, unlike the others, maybe she wasn't going to exploit them. Anyway, she kind of just trumps right up to them, like they're a gang of girl guides or something. Meanwhile, Mel seems to have found access to the service ducts at the back of this cubicle in the hydroponic centre, so there may be another way of escape. The Vervoids say that they do recognise Lasky, but they say that all animal kind is their enemy. it's an appalling piece of acting from Honor Blackman. She doesn't react to that remark. She just stands there, gets thorned, and is carried off. You think, the minute the Vervoids say all animal kind is their enemy, that would ring alarm bells, would you?
Yeah, would it not? You'd back away a bit, wouldn't you?
She doesn't, and gets what she deserves.
Mm. Yeah, nice little scene actually in the pulverizer room, don't we? Yeah. With the man struggling with one of the vervoids, and he manages to push it into the pulverizer. But then, unfortunately, another one arrives and zaps him.
Thorn from behind.
Ooh, nasty. And then Mel and the Doctor have managed to escape, haven't they, through the ducting. They come across the vervoid's parlour.
Their charnel house.
Mel says it's obscene, and the Doctor asks her what... He points out to her, you know, what do you do with plants that you uproot in your garden at home? And she says, well, I put them on the compost heap. And she realises what he's getting at. You know, it's a human compost heap. And they're just obeying instinct.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure that making a compost heap is an instinctive act.
No, I guess it's not really instinctive, is it?
It's not the prime directive, but it's probably not even the tertiary directive to make compost heaps. Must make compost heap.
Compost. We need more compost. Yes, that's true. Anyway, she's upset and she cries into his lapel. And as she's doing so, he kind of looks up at the lights that are overhead. There's kind of lights of all these ducting, isn't there?
And a thought strikes him.
It does. You almost see a light bulb appear over his head.
So, back to the passenger lounge. The vervoids are desperately trying to get in through these double doors, and Janet and the guards are trying to block these doors with the various items of conservatory furniture. The Doctor and Mel arrive on the bridge. The Doctor suggests that instead of trying to kill the vervoids, why don't they just accelerate their life cycle? He knows that the hull contains vianesium, which is a rare metal found on the airless Mogar. It's similar to magnesium, so when exposed to oxygenated air, it releases incredibly intense light and carbon dioxide. He's basically saying the vervoids would get spring, summer, autumn, all condensed into a few moments. Travis is not keen because vianesium is worth a prince's ransom, which is not as much as the normal phrase, which is a king's ransom. So it's not that expensive, it's just quite expensive.
Yeah, it's kind of like the next level down expensive.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Travis is worried that he'll get into trouble for basically plundering the vault that he's taking from Mogar to Earth. But he basically realises, you know, the communication rooms have been destroyed, they're cut off from anything. He's got no choice, and that's it, really. So he gives the Doctor the keys to the vault. The Doctor says, well, first they need to drive the vervoids back to their lair by plunging the ship into darkness.
So the Commodore announces over the tannoy that there's a fault with the generator and that the heating and lighting is going to be shut down for repairs. So the lights go off, and all that's left is the sort of emergency lights. Then suddenly the vervoids are all back in their lair, aren't they? They would do wonder if it's a trick, don't they?
Mm.
We see the Doctor and Mel kind of hiding nearby, and they've got these little homemade bombs with them, haven't they? They've obviously got this vianesium inside. We see a vervoid coming towards Mel through the ducting. I don't know where it'd been, because all the others were there, but this one just decides to blunder through towards it.
They did say that there was one of the men turned up.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Oh, I might have been losing interest at that point.
you've done well to get this far.
So she screams, and she's surrounded by vervoids, and the Doctor shouts out, the vianesium, and they throw the bombs, and there's loads of bright flashes of light as these things explode, and the Doctor and Mel kind of run away, and the vervoids start to collapse to the floor, don't they, and the leaves start to fall off, they go all brown, and they start making this horrible moaning, wailing noise, don't they, which you can hear throughout the ship.
Mm. Actually, as you pan through the other parts of the ship, you see a random crew member sort of cozying up to a receptionist, Janet, in the gloom, don't you?
Lucky bastard.
Those guys, something's going to happen there. I just know it. I really do.
Ah, good for them.
Mm.
It wasn't the beardy, weirdy one, was it?
No, otherwise I'd be utterly against it.
Anyway, the leaves all fall to the floor and start blowing around, and the vervoids just crumple away to nothing, don't they? And then the Doctor calls over the communicator to tell the Commodore to restore power, and the lights come back on.
There's a slightly crappy bit, is that where the Doctor sadly holds his Vervoid Leaf in his an entirely unrealistic hand, which just sort of crumbles into nothing, doesn't it? Not the hand, the leaf.
Yes.
But the hand doesn't look right, does it? Firstly, it's not fat enough to be Colin Baker's hand. There's not massive sausage fingers, you know, trying to hold this leaf. And then it just all happens as if it was a model with a leaf on it, which I suspect it was.
I think you could be right.
Or even just a picture of a hand with a leaf superimposed on it. You know, whatever it is, it's not right.
It's certainly not a hand.
It's not even a foot.
No, it's definitely not a foot. Anyway, without wanting to name any more body parts as it's not, we'll carry on.
That could get nasty.
So, we're outside the TARDIS. The Doctor and Mel are saying goodbye to the Commodore and Janet, who appear to be the only ones left. The Commodore hopes that it's going to be their final meeting. And then we get a load of old nonsense about the Doctor referring to Mel as an elephant, and her asking them if they've heard the Doctor's rendition of On With the Motley again.
Yeah, because that was funny the first time.
And as they go into the TARDIS, we hear the Doctor start to sing. So thankfully, it disappears.
Well, the key thing is, it's a classic showbiz phrase, isn't it? Always leave them wanting less.
Correct.
Oh,
certainly works in this instance.
Dreadful. So then, almost mercifully, we return to the courtroom. The Doctor explains that none of the Vervoids could be allowed to survive, as just one of their leaves on fertile ground would have produced a Vervoid, and that would be enough to eliminate the human race. But the Valiard pounces on this and says the charge of meddling is now relevant, because the Doctor is now charged with a much greater crime, and that is genocide. He's killed an entire race, you know, entire species. There's a shot of the Doctor's face, as we've become accustomed to, and the story ends, or not the story, but these four episodes. The sub-story ends, if that's nicer.
Mm.
But, I mean, I have to say on this particular point, they're talking about Article 7 of Gallifreyan law permits no exceptions to genocide. Of course, unless it's the Time Lords trying to stop the Daleks from existing in the first place in Genesis of the Daleks. Apparently that's great.
Yes, yes. Nothing wrong with that. This is what happens when you no longer have a script editor.
You only have a man in a Hawaiian shirt with no idea of what is rubbish and what is good.
Yes. So, Jim, what did you think of this story?
I do remember at the time, as I say, I'd virtually lost the faith by this stage as it was broadcast. But I caught some of this. And at the time, I thought it was a return to a kind of old-school Who, really. I think I saw all of Mysterious Planet. I didn't see all of Mind Warper, and I didn't see all of this, but of the bits that I had seen of this season, I thought this looked like the best story. And in fact, you know, the Agatha Christie-style stuff is pretty good. It's, you know, a little bit different. We had something like it with the Robots of Death, didn't we?
Mm.
In that sense, I think it was good, and there was quite a few surprises, and I thought the death of the Vervoids was pretty good. I would have liked to have seen their faces wither as well, but as they were foam rubber, there was nothing I could do with that. But whatever qualities, you know, this production has are destroyed by the appalling dialogue. For me, this is, in terms of dialogue, this is the worst story of any in, well, yeah, New Who or Classic Who. Even Time of the Rani's bit in this, the only one I noticed being particularly awful was the dialogue for Mel in Time of the Rani was dreadful.
Yeah, it was.
I didn't think everyone else was that bad. There's barely a line that sounds naturalistic. You know, as I said before, it's thesaurus dialogue. Long words do not an intelligent script make.
Mm.
You can't gild the turd with long words. The script isn't even a turd. The plotting is very good on this. It's quite complex, and the plotting is is interesting. There's lots of reveals that happen. You know, you don't have to wait long for something new to be revealed. And I think it, in those terms, it's probably Pip and Jane Baker's best script, but the dialogue is easily their worst. It's dreadful.
It is absolutely dreadful, and it unfortunately takes you away from the story all the time.
That's the thing,
because you just can't believe what utter tripe they're talking.
You're plucked out of the narrative every time a ludicrous sentence is uttered by one of the actors.
Hmm.
And I feel sorry for the actors in this. I really do.
I feel sorry for some of them.
Some are better than others, and we'll get to that. But, dreadful. But what do you think in overall terms?
I would totally agree with everything you said, to be honest. The dialogue does destroy it. Plot-wise, as you've said, it's actually quite good.
Mm.
In fact, as a kind of a whodunit clever plot, it's better than Robots of Death.
Oh, yeah, because you know who's done it pretty early on in Robots of Death. Mm.
But yeah, like I said, with the Verboids, they're quite an interesting kind of monster.
Mm.
There's some good bits in it, you know, some good sort of set pieces in it. Like the end of episode one is really, really good.
No, it's excellent, yeah.
For instance, some of the direction's quite good, I think. But it becomes almost unwatchable because of the absolute drivel that comes out of everybody's mouth. I mean, we go on to the main cast. What do you think of Colin Baker?
Colin Baker, well, in positive terms, he's more likeable than he has been. He's less angry, isn't he, than he has been, and he has a better relationship with his companion than mm-hmm. he has had. But, I mean, I have to say, I mean, I think Colin Baker is a nice bloke. Having watched him on Come Dine With Me recently, he looks like an absolute top bloke, slightly tempered by the fact I've heard some fairly ripe remarks he's made in some commentaries, or DVD commentaries before. So I'm a little bit undecided about him. But much as I think I like Colin Baker as a person, his acting is very rarely naturalistic, is it? He almost always looks like he's acting.
Mm-hmm.
And that, when you come after Peter Davison, who's a very naturalistic actor, this is difficult to swallow, I think.
I don't think it really matters who he came after. I just don't think he's very good.
No, the reason I mention Davison is the fact that he's incredibly naturalistic. He delivers every line as if it hasn't been written for him. He delivers it as if it's come out of his head.
Yeah.
And that's what we're aiming for, isn't it?
Of course.
But Colin Baker is the other end of the spectrum. I can't dislike the man, but you have to do fanciful stuff like this. You have to take it seriously. It's the same with comedy. The minute you say, all right, I'm in a comedy, I don't have to act properly, the comedy falls on its arse. And it's the same with science fiction. The minute you look like you're not a character in something that is actually happening, with science fiction more so than anything else, because you're suspending disbelief as much as you can already, you're going to ruin it. So Colin Baker is not a good actor to be the Doctor, in my opinion.
Well, I agree. I mean, and he's more like, he's almost a pantomime actor like Bonnie Langford is. It's all big gestures and big, bold statements and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, she is only slightly more musical theatre than Colin Baker is. And when you've got two of them, the two people are supposed to be the anchors of the show. When you've got both of them that are unconvincing on the small screen, you're in trouble, and we are in trouble in this period of Doctor Who.
Definitely. Some of those courtroom scenes with this just horrible smugness and pomposity, and it just makes you cry. It's just, how could they mess it up so badly? I don't entirely blame him, because, you know, it's a joint effort, isn't it, when you're trying to build a character like that.
It is.
And the thing is with him, that he's not a bad actor, and he is, I totally agree with you, he's a nice bloke. I mean, I listen to Big Finish all the time, and he's brilliant on those.
Oh, yeah.
He's done a really good job with those.
He's unanimously the best Big Finish Doctor, isn't he?
Exactly. And he listened to him talking, you know, he's a nice bloke, and he really cares about it, and he really wants to, you know, he really cares for character in the show. But unfortunately, when he was the Doctor on TV, I really have to say he was terrible.
Mm.
I think, unfortunately, he wasn't any good.
Well, I mean,
for the reasons that you've given, it just doesn't. He just feels like he's somebody trying too hard to find a character for himself. Whereas what he'd been better off doing, which the last two did, is you just play yourself. You know, Tom Baker, Peter Davison, all they did was just turned up and played themselves.
Well, it seems to me that Colin Baker was acting against type. I mean, he seems to be such a nice bloke. If he'd done what Tom Baker had done, if he'd done what John Pertwee had done and just played himself, he would have been more likeable than John Pertwee, certainly, for playing himself. And he could have been, you know, like a slightly lighter version of Tom Baker. But he is more like it in this story. I mean, that's a little bit of a red herring for this one, because, you know, he was so unpleasant before this. He's pleasant in this, isn't he? But his acting...
He's pleasant enough, but he's acting, yeah.
It just doesn't cut it.
Well, a lot of it's dialogue. Terrible, terrible dialogue. I'd be interested to see the other episode. Well, I'd be interested to see Mind Warp, actually, previous story, where you know, you're going to get better dialogue, I'm sure.
Well, it's not Pip and Jane Baker, for one thing.
Exactly. I'd like to see that, to look at his performance in that, and see what I really think of him, you know, where he's actually delivering some hopefully something meaningful from his mouth. the rubbish he had to do here.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to kind of judge one from the other with this.
Well, you have to judge this one on the words he has to say and how he delivers them.
Hmm.
I mean, a lot of the words are not that easy to deliver because they're badly written. But, you know, a skilled actor must make the best of what he's given. And he doesn't make it any better, I don't think, most of the time. No. He does have the odd moment of naturalistic acting. I mean, I can't pluck one out at the moment, but I noticed some during it. But his Doctor is all about being overblown. Again, you know, the opposite of Davison, isn't it? I mean, that's how they always go, don't they? They're almost the opposite of the incarnation before them, which is fine, and it makes some sense. But if you've come off the back of someone who's naturalistic, then you're almost not allowed to be naturalistic. So, yeah, maybe you shouldn't be blaming Colin Baker for that, but I didn't watch this thinking another Doctor could have done it better. That never occurred to me. Because the problems...
No.
There are more problems than that. I mean, the problem is not the Doctor in this.
It doesn't help that it's him.
Yeah, but if you had Tom Baker in this, it would have been in that, in the season of the Nine-One, wouldn't it? Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's I can't imagine the grave of Tom Baker being given this script.
No, it would have been disappointing.
Although, I mean, plot-wise, there is not a lot wrong with this one. I mean, I think it's cleverly plotted. My beef with Pip and Jane Baker is not about the plot. It's not about anything other than the words they make their characters say.
Mm. Anyway, shall we have a look at some of the others? Bonnie Langford?
Well, as I said, she is miscast. There's no doubt about that.
Mm.
She's miscast in the sense that she is almost a recognised kind of archetype, which will not work in Doctor Who. And that's why everyone, including myself, threw their arms up in horror when they heard it. That she was going to be cast as the next companion, particularly as I quite like Perry, except that she whinged all the time.
Mm.
You just thought, well, this is beginning of the end, and we've got you know, people all over the world listening to this. I mean, I don't know what anyone else knows about Bonnie Langford, but in Britain, she was Violet Elizabeth Bott in the William Brown stories, you know, Just William and all that kind of stuff, and she used to scream and scream until she was sick. Which is presumably why she was cast in Doctor Who, where she screams more than any companion since Victoria, probably.
Yeah.
There's a lot of screaming there, but, and this is why this character is not very well written, and not just by Pippa Jane Baker, it's the fact that you can't have someone who is this brave and enthusiastic and clever, who also screams as much as she does.
I agree.
That doesn't work, does it?
It's inconsistent, isn't it?
Yeah. What I like about it, as I said, controversially, is she is a breath of fresh air. She'd be more of a breath of fresh air if Bonnie Langford hadn't been cast, probably, depending on who they had cast. But, you know, this is not a job for a musical theatre person. I don't think it's unfair to say that that is her forte. And I do hear a lot of slagging off of Bonnie Langford, and I understand it, but at the same time, I don't think she does a bad job for her skill set. I think she's enthusiastic. She does what she's expected to do in every script, I think.
Mm.
But she does it from the starting point of musical theatre, which is too unrealistic or unnaturalistic for Doctor Who. I don't blame Bonnie Langford as a person for this. The way the character had written it is quite good, although if you look at the info notes on the DVD and you read JNT's sort of character synopsis for Mel, it's almost worse than what you actually see on the screen. Have you read it, Martin?
No.
It's really quite a sexist piece of writing of a character by JNT, because he wrote the character, as far as I know. I don't think he got any help in it. She's intelligent and she's a bit pushy and she wants stuff to happen and she has to be a little bit in control of it at least. And she's feminist. But when anything nasty happens, she screams like a tiny girl. Yeah, that is not the actual words of the character synopsis, but it's pretty much what is supposed to happen. It's almost misogynistic the way that JNT has written Mel's character, because he's almost trying to pour scorn on any female who has, you know, feminist ideals.
Mm.
He's talking about this character who is, you know, a very clever computer programmer from Peas Pottage. She's very into her fitness, and she's trying to get the doctor fit. She gives him carrot juice, and it's hilarious. and then it goes into a little bit about, you know, she's all into feminism stuff. And then it says something like, and I can't quote it exactly, because I watched it once during this and didn't make any notes in it, but it's something like a lot of annoying feminists, you know, when it comes to her being in danger, she screams like hell for the doctor. Yeah, that's great in the 1960s to write a character like that. Not in the 1980s. Not when you've had Tegan already.
Well, Sarah Jane.
Yeah, I mean,
Sarah used to scream it from time to time, but only when it was really called for.
Yeah, Leela screamed occasionally.
Yeah.
But those two characters are a far better template to start a new character on. I mean, this is absurd. I mean, a lot of people let JNT off the problems that happened in under his era. The more I get to know what happens under his era, the more I blame him, to be honest. I mean, he is making loads of decisions that are wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Bonnie Langford,
I mean, this whole season is terrible.
The whole premise of the season is wrong. If this is supposed to be a jumping on point for new viewers, it's precisely the opposite of what you need to be doing.
Yeah.
You don't present them with a 14-part story banging on about Gallifrey to start with. That is exactly what you do not do if you're trying to bring new viewers in. What they did to start with seemed fantastic. They spent absolutely 90% of the budget on that scene of the TARDIS being sucked in to wherever the High Council is based, the space station. Fantastic. I watched that and I thought, my God, things are going to change now when we see this new series. If that is what the special effects are like, this is going to be fantastic. Of course.
And then 2 minutes later, you realise the truth.
Yeah. That was where all the special effects budget was spent. I mean, JNT has always been lauded for being brilliant at working in the media. And, yeah, he's done a cracking job here because everyone's going to tune in. And, Doctor Who's crap special effects. Oh, hang on a minute. Maybe it doesn't anymore. I like science fiction. I like good effects. You know, I like the Star Wars trilogy. Maybe I'll have a look. And that's great. But you've got to back it up. You don't back it up with Mysterious Planet, Mind Warp, and Terror of the Vervoids, do you?
Not through choice, no.
Well, you do, because you've got no budget left after that initial scene. Mm. I think he was great in the way he did that kind of stuff. I don't think it's great to stunt cast just to get yourself in the papers every week.
And what you want to do is you want to keep your ratings up, or you know, reverse the trend of dropping ratings. And
yeah,
okay, you'll get a bit of publicity for a week or whatever, but that's it. You know, and it's bad publicity as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with the fact, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. There is. And whoever said that is an idiot.
Too true.
What I would say about the regulars is the chemistry between Bonnie Langford and Colin Baker is far, far better than it was in Nicola Bryant. And that's not her fault, I'm sure.
As we said earlier, it's more realistic that the Doctor would be travelling with somebody like Mel than somebody like Perry or Tegan.
Although, you know these stories better than I do, but in the first two stories of this season, I think the relationship with Perry was better than it had been.
Oh, yeah, it had. And even, you know, if you look at Revelation of the Daleks, I think they'd already started to mellow it a bit there as well.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so supporting cast?
I thought Otto Blackman was pretty good. I mean, she had a couple of bits where she failed, I think. You know, her death scene, as you mentioned, was a bit lame.
I don't know. I think she was phoning it in throughout.
Really?
I really do, yeah.
Okay, I thought she was okay, but I guess it's difficult, you know, with the dialogue they're given. I thought she was...
You're absolutely right. That is a massive problem. I must be blinded by my professional vanity.
Yeah. Well, that was a terrible line.
There's no way you can make that sound like it came out of a human being's mouth.
Yeah, and she failed with that, definitely. But for the rest of it, I think she did okay with what she'd got.
What I would say is for Honor Blackman, it was disappointing. It was nice to have her there, definitely. But it was not a role for her to be, you know, like we have known Honor Blackman to be, you know, like sort of coquettish yet strong sort of female. It wasn't that role anyway. Yeah, you could argue that she was miscast, but...
How do you cast anybody to deliver these lines?
Like, you'd cast new scriptwriters, I think, would be the cleverest thing to do.
Michael Craig, who played the Commodore. I quite liked him, actually.
I thought he was great.
Yeah.
I think he probably thought he was in the wrong programme.
He, to me, was the only one who really seemed to have any conviction about them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he had some of the worst dialogue to say.
But he seemed to get away with it better.
Well, yeah.
And maybe there is a trick to it. Maybe he's just a better actor than the others.
He's the best actor there, definitely.
Mm.
He's great. I remember him from... Do you remember Triangle, Martin?
Vaguely. I mean, he was familiar, but I couldn't think where it's from, and it's from Triangle.
Yeah, Triangle was this fairly awful soap opera, wasn't it? Based on... I can't remember even where it was... It's going to and from, but it's some kind of sort of shuttle passenger liner, wasn't it? He was the captain in that. He actually was probably the only good thing in that. Although it also included Kate O'Mara, he was still the best thing in it. And, you know, he's almost typecast as the commander of another ship here. And he's about one of the only convincing things in this. And he must have wondered what on earth he was doing there and what on earth he was expected to say, because he also actually has some of the worst lines to deliver.
Yeah. Rudge. I think Rudge was pretty terrible.
I thought it was okay until he had to, until he came to the hijack, and then he...
Yeah, he was terrible in the hijack.
Unraveled, couldn't he, at that point? I actually thought he was quite good before that.
I quite liked him with his sort of, his interplay with Janet. He seemed quite affable to start with, didn't he? And then
genial, wasn't he?
Yeah, and then his character changes when Commodore starts having a go at him, and then when he pulls the gun on him, and his character changes completely, isn't it? And he didn't pull that off at all, I didn't think.
No, it's a shame, because I remember thinking he was actually good, and then it came to that, it's Dennis Hawthorne, isn't it? When it came to that throwing the keys on the floor bit, and that didn't seem to make any sense, except for the fact they needed the keys to the vault later on.
Yeah,
but I don't think a character would have done that particularly.
No.
But I would then move on to Malcolm Tierney as Dowland and David Alistair as Bruckner. I thought they were both really good. If you consider that Leaden dialogue there delivered, particularly Bruckner.
Mm.
He had some stuff that is just unsayable. But what I liked about him was he did some nice sort of edge of scene acting. He was reacting properly to stuff that was happening that would affect his character, and he was on screen at the time. He did that really well.
Yeah, okay.
And I just really liked him. Not so much Dolan, but Dolan was okay, I think. But David Alistair, I think, stood out a bit as Bruckner.
Yeah, I don't know if he stood out particularly. I'd agree with you. I thought they were both fairly good. I quite like Dolan's calm, almost deadpan delivery of stuff.
Yeah, that was good, yeah.
But again, I think, again, when he's finally revealed as the killer, didn't really ring true with his character. So I guess that's not a criticism of the actor there. It's just, perhaps it's going back to the script again. Throughout, he just seems to be getting on with his job, doesn't he? And his,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I suppose that makes his revelation more shocking, but you need to seed something in there, don't you?
You do, really, because otherwise it all has to be explained in the dialogue.
Yeah.
And as you said, it isn't...
Never satisfactory.
It's not a satisfactory reason, is it? Not least because the doctor says, oh, it's avarice, and he says, no, it's not, and then goes on to explain that it's avarice.
That's poor. But what I would say is that I enjoyed both of their performances.
Mm.
And that's not to say they were perfect, but I enjoyed watching them on the screen.
Yeah.
So... Yolande Palfrey as Janet.
I liked her. I thought she was quite good, actually.
I'd prefer her to be a companion than Bonnie Langford, to be honest.
Definitely,
and
yeah.
I suppose that was ever going to happen, but she was a nice sympathy character. It's a difficult role to play, that one, isn't it? You know, the waitress thinking about the bigger scheme of things and all the rest of it. Yeah, I thought she did well at that. And nice legs.
Yeah, nice legs. And she, I thought she acted it well, you know.
She did, yeah. She was convincing throughout, I think.
Yeah. Arthur Hewlett as Kimber.
Good enough.
Good enough. I mean, he's been in all sorts of things, that fellow, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He just kind of plays the same character and everything.
Yeah, it's a very familiar face, isn't it? The old gaffer.
I quite liked Simon Slater as Edward. So I thought he was good.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
He didn't have a huge role, did he? But what he did have was good. Apart from his bizarre final line.
Yeah. Yeah. Not his fault, but what in the hell was going to happen next?
And then Hammett.
Well, as I said.
Tony Scoggo.
Tony Scoggo, I thought was tragic in this. Terrible. We only had one line and it was awful.
Yeah, it was pretty poor.
I would say.
It was better when he was creeping about as a Bulgarian.
When he couldn't see his face.
But generally, though, I mean, we've said most of them have done a reasonable job.
Oh, yeah, I would say.
One or two apart. So, yeah, you know, they've tried their utmost.
Well, the thing is, I mean, we're looking at it. I mean, the regulars were the regulars, weren't they? I mean, it's not for this story that they're like that. I mean, that's what they are like in the stories that they are in. The supporting cast were good enough.
Yes, I mean, there's a couple more. We've got Michael Jason as the Valiard and Linda Bellingham as the Inquisitor.
Oh, yeah, I was forgetting about them. I mean, they are a thorn in our sides throughout the season. Linda Bellingham is fine, and Michael Jason is great in the role. It's just he's got some terrible dialogue. He's got some Pip and Jane Baker-style dialogue, hasn't he? And not just in this story, as I remember.
Mm.
I mean, he says stuff that no human being or Time Lord even would ever say.
The difficulty there, especially in these first three stories, and you know this one that we've been looking at, is he's just sat there. In a court, all you can do is speak, and so all you can judge him on is what he says, and most of it's drivel.
Yeah.
You know, he's a good actor, as we know.
It's a tough gig trying to get this stuff over convincing.
Hmm. So the Verboids, well, we talked about this quite a bit earlier when they first appeared, didn't we?
Mm.
And I thought they were reasonably good for what they were, you know. And I like the idea of them. You know, it's an interesting idea.
It's a great idea, definitely.
Premise of, you know, these plants that are kind of fighting back. You weren't so keen on the bone rubber faces, were you?
No, but I mean, that is just what comes with the era. I mean, that's how stuff was done.
Hmm.
It unfortunately means everyone looks like they're in a suit.
Yeah.
It's not helped, actually. They employed dancers, didn't they, to play the Verboids. and they're moving around in ludicrous ways, aren't they?
I don't know why they did that. Is it, what's wrong with them just kind of just walking normally? Or
plant is not going to have extravagant movement, is it? That is the nature of plants.
Slow.
So all these are throwing themselves around. It's just like, oh, I'm a dancer. Oh, look at this.
Look at me move.
Yeah, it's not what's required in the story. So, yeah, regardless of what's good or bad about the actual costume, and I think the kind of leaves parts are excellent. Face is anything I object to. Even the kind of crowning bit behind them, it looks good. It looks plant-like. But, yeah, I mean, it's ludicrous movement, and, you know, slightly unconvincing voices just detract from what could have been, you know, up there with the crinoid, really, in terms of really, really alien life, you know, stuff that's not even animal kind.
Mm.
It's an interesting area to plumb with science fiction, and you know, I don't really think enough was done in this one.
I say, I mean, I thought they were good enough for this. They were reasonably convincing, I thought, and at times I thought they're one of the better realised aliens.
Yeah, good enough, but could have been better. So, so what about the Megarians?
I mean, when they take their masks off aside, we'll come to that in a minute, but when they're just wandering around, they're all right. I mean, they're just people in suits.
I go further than that. I think they look really good, actually. I thought the design of their heads was excellent. But when they took the masks off, it just didn't make any sense.
No.
Why would you have this organic grill on your mouth? It doesn't follow through. I don't understand it. I mean, if it was something that had to be...
It's ludicrous.
Yeah, if it was something to be added to them, then why would it look like the rest of them?
Mm.
It would have to be some kind of prosthetic that was put on them to help them breathe.
Maybe this mask has been pressing too hard on their face. It doesn't normally look like that.
It left an imprint. Maybe that was it. One other thing I want to say about Megarians is about these translator units. We're led to believe, you know, this is a 1,000 years in advance of... when this story was transmitted. Do these translator units have to be as huge and as clunky as they are? And why don't they remember ever to use them without someone reminding them? All that is just put in for that one plot point, isn't it?
Yep.
Which probably could have been done another way.
Hmm.
So, what do you reckon on sets then?
Very 80s. Well, I thought the hydroponics set was pretty good, actually.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, everything else was fairly rubbish, I thought, actually. It's all just kind of brightly lit corridors. And the lounge room, well, you gave a good description of it, didn't you? With the prop plants around and wicker chairs and things.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay, but I suppose, you know, on a space liner, it's going to be fairly functional, isn't it, really? But, yeah, the standout set was definitely the hydroponics centre, which they seem to have put quite a lot of work into.
I would say that, yeah. I didn't have any objections to the corridors and stuff like that. I thought they were good enough. It was kind of like a business class places where you would put people in for a fairly shortish trip. You know, it was good enough, I thought. I thought the bridge was very old-fashioned. It was like Blake 7, wasn't it, or Park in Space. I mean, it was just...
A big window.
Yeah, I mean, the effects are certainly no better than Ark in Space. And, you know, that was 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
But I liked it. I didn't think it was a downpour. I enjoyed the nostalgia of it. But, I mean, you shouldn't be enjoying nostalgia on something that's supposed to be futuristic.
No. Yeah, I thought it was... They were all right. I mean, the pulverizer room was... reminded me of... Is it something like the Sunmakers, where K-9 gets almost taken into...
But I think that was a lot more realistic, I think, than the Sunmaker.
Yeah, it just reminded me of that scene, though. Yeah, the direction, I thought it was quite good in parts. There were some nice point of view shots, weren't there, from the vervoids, sort of coming out of the pods and all that kind of stuff. And I thought the shots sort of inside the ducting were quite good as well.
Yeah.
They had a kind of claustrophobic feel to it, didn't they? You know, they didn't give away the who the killer was. You know, they showed just enough to give an idea, but never gave away, you know, who it was. So, I mean, they did that quite effectively.
Mm.
I like that opening shot, like I said, of the Hyperion 3, where it pans into the lounge through the windows.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pretty solid. What about you?
Yeah, well, I thought it was good enough. Again, there was some handheld camera, wasn't there, on occasions, which was...
Mm-hmm.
added a little bit of mild excitement. Overall, I would say it was unremarkable and unmemorable in terms of, you know, direction, flair. But, you know, it told the story, and I suppose you can't ask for much more than that. You know, if you tell the story, you've done your job. If you add a few bags of flashes, you've done a bit more than your job. But I think Chris Clubb did his job here. In terms of the model work and the special effects, as I said before, I thought, this, without exception, really, the space scenes were dreadful. Really, considering we've gone this far with Doctor Who, you know, there were better space scenes than this years ago.
Yeah, in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, these are particularly awful. His ship in flight is dreadful.
So, yeah, I mean, like you say, the model work in this is pretty ropey.
Well, this is like going back 10 years.
It is.
There's model work in Pertwee era is better than this.
Because it was like proper model work.
Yeah.
This is some
green screen. I don't know, I mean, even if the ship is a model, I don't know what it is, but it's not convincing.
Yeah, so that's fairly ropey. But you don't get a great deal of it, do you, really?
No, you get enough to ruin the illusion, but no, you get acres of it, no.
No. We said about the black hole effect isn't great either, is it? To say the least.
What are those sort of white triangular things? Without that, it would probably look quite good. Oh, those are ridiculous.
Yeah, not good. Anything to say on costumes?
Yeah, I mean, they're good enough. You know, it's all kind of serviceable stuff for the kind of ship that it was. I thought the costumes for the Megarians is pretty good. Yeah, we can't comment on Colin Baker's costume. Not his fault.
Nice burgundy uniforms for the guards.
Yeah.
Complete with moustaches.
Yeah, they came with the uniform. And some of the outfits remind me of Frontier in Space, those big padded shoulders.
Oh, yeah.
Commodore Travers, particularly, and I think Raj had these kind of puffed-up shoulders that were quite like ones in Frontier in Space, which I thought was a nice step back. In fact, all that kind of stuff on the bridge felt very, very retro, with that kind of arc in space, view of space.
Yeah.
And these people wearing Frontier in Space outfits. It's really quite retro.
Yeah. So, music.
Music, yeah. Mm. Malcolm Clark, the incidental music here. Not a favourite of mine. In fact, yeah, no disrespect to him, but probably my least favourite of the Doctor Who composers of that era. I honestly can't remember any of it.
No, I can't either, which probably means it wasn't that bad, to be honest.
Well, it certainly wasn't that jarring, was it?
No, it didn't jar, definitely. So, yeah, so it probably did a good job. As I said before, if you don't notice it, then it's pretty good. But, of course, the theme music itself, as we mentioned at the start, is terrible.
Yeah.
Definitely the worst theme tune that of the whole run, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it might be a life or death tussle with Kev McCulloch's theme.
That's true.
But, Sylvester McCoy. But if you think about music in this story, what you are left with is not the incidental music, it's the opening, closing music. Because incidental music really is unremarkable.
That's right.
So, Martin, shall we move on to our ratings of this particular story?
Yes, why not? Shall I go first?
Go on, then.
I would give this 5. I've thought long and hard about it. I think the thing that really dragged it down is the dialogue. I think plot-wise, it's okay. And we said there's some reasonable performances in it. For me, the leads don't help it as a story. But I think there's enough going on in it. And it looks reasonably good. So it gets a 5. I'm going to rate it slightly higher than Time of the Rani, which I gave 4. So I think, for me, it's a 5. It's rubbish, really. There's some good bits to it. So.
Okay, well, in a way, I'm going to follow you, because I'm going to give it slightly more than I gave Time of the Rani. I gave Time of the Rani a 5. I just can't quite believe when there's 4s, 3s, 2s and 1s to be had. But I did. And that was down to McCoy, really, after the initial flurries, first couple of scenes, that, you know, that's what saved it for me. In a way, that's one of the things that is against this one, is the Doctor's portrayal. What I would say is good about it is the plotting, which I think is very tight, and it really gives a succession of reveals.
Yeah.
You get revealed you know, who Hallett is, you get revealed that Raj is staging a kind of a coup. You get revealed about Doland, and you get further revelations about the Verboids. It's quite densely and cleverly plotted, and that is down to Pip and Jane Baker. But so is the dialogue. If this had had utterly banal, average dialogue, it would have been pretty good, I think.
Yeah.
As it hasn't even got that, and it's got dialogue that just makes you hate it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do what you did. I'm going to give it a point more than I gave Time in the Rani. Almost reluctantly, because even in that story, I like Sylvester McCoy's Doctor so much better.
Yeah.
But everything else is better about this than Time in the Rani, so I think that makes it a 6 for me.
Yeah. It's a much better story, much better plot than Time in the Rani,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And it looks a lot better.
True.
So that, for me, is why I've scored it higher. But in the bizarre kind of way, I enjoyed Time of the Rani more. It's weird, really.
Well, I know what you mean.
Probably for the same reasons, actually, because McCoy's got something about him.
What I remembered about Time of the Rani is McCoy being rubbish, but in fact, McCoy's the best thing about it. What I remembered about this, I'm not convinced I saw all of it when it was broadcast, and I certainly haven't seen it since, but I kind of remember it being, you know, almost old school Who in a way. And one of the things that detracted from that was the Doctor and his companion, you know, which is you know, pretty much unforgivable. So you end up in a strange kind of hinterland about story and Doctor and where you put your priorities and, you know, where you put your marks out of 10. But I still think, despite all that, I'd rather watch this than Time in the Rani. So for that reason, it gets an extra mark.
Fair enough. I just wonder, actually, when we watched it as, how old we would have been at the time, but, you know, much younger than we are now, obviously, whether the awfulness of the dialogue may have kind of washed over us more, and so we'd probably been slightly more impressed with it as a story than we are now.
I think that's absolutely true. I thought, and I still think, actually, it's quite a novel scenario for it to be set in on this cruise liner in space.
Yeah.
Which doesn't happen that often. No, it happened in the one of those Christmas specials. But that's not, you know, a well that Doctor Who keeps coming back to, is it? It's quite unusual.
Yeah.
And I remember that being impressive because it felt a bit fresh and a bit different. So I think there's a lot that's good about this, but dialogue is so important.
It is.
And it's so awful in this. And it's just two people trying to sound clever. I mean, they are clever in terms of plotting. To give those reveals in those ways, you know, in that sort of domino way that they do it. That is good plotting.
Mm-hmm.
But the dialogue is below amateur. It's someone trying to sound impressive.
And as you say, it just ruins, you know, what could have been a decent story. And drags it right down towards the bottom of the heap, really.
I can't think of a story that's got worse dialogue than this. I cannot think of one.
Well, we'll have to watch some more Pip and Joan Baker to see if they can outdo themselves.
Do you mind if I opt out?
We'll have to do the finale. In fact, I think episode 14 has got even worse stuff in. So one of these days, we'll do that.
Okay, well, we're aware this is quite a long episode of the Critter podcast already. So there is some feedback. It's on the Facebook pages, and it's well worth reading. There's some good stuff in there. But unfortunately, on this occasion, we don't really have time to include it, so head over there. A quick way to get there is to go to our blog pages, which are at crinoid.blog.co.uk. If you look to the top left-hand corner, you'll see a link to our Facebook page. Hit that, and you'll get there. And you'll see what everyone's got to say about their thoughts on this particular story. Thanks for all those thoughts, by the way, and sorry I haven't got time to put them in this time.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Right, what are we going to do next then, Jim?
Well, from one controversial companion to the next, well, to a previous, I should say, we're going to do Full Circle.
Hey.
The last season of Tom Baker, and the first story of a young lad called Adric.
Hurrah.
Or Haru, more accurate.
Yeah, looking forward to that one.
Mm. So if you've got any thoughts on Full Circle, then get to us in the usual ways via email at crinoid@mail.com, or go to our blog pages at crinoid.blog.co.uk, or go to our Facebook pages. As I've described, you can get there from the blog pages. Or you can tweet us your thoughts, or indeed follow us. If you go to Twitter, we are at crinoid. So, all that remains is for us to say thanks very much for listening, and it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next time.
Every vervoid was destroyed by your ingenious plan.
Yes?
Whether or not the Doctor has proved himself innocent of meddling is no longer the cardinal issue before this court. He has proved himself guilty of a far greater crime.
You refer to Article 7 of Gallifreyan law?
No, my lady, that cannot apply. Had a single vervoid reached Earth, the human race would have been eliminated.
Article 7 permits no exceptions. The Doctor has destroyed a complete species. The charge must now be genocide.